from Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Mads. Neo-Futurist alumni Dave All, Rachel Klaff, and Phil Ritterelli. And the Swap Meet returns with Greg Flam. Now here is your host, a man who needs a space heater on his head, Justin Kaufman.
Or at least those things you put in your pocket, like the hand warmers. Tried one of those on the top of my bald head. I take it. Welcome to the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Very happy to be on the air here on this blistery cold evening here in Chicago. December to remember, as they say in the commercials. We're not really necessarily remembering it for putting a bow on a luxury sedan. No, we're going to remember it for being one of the coldest months of all time. That's what's going to happen. We got a great show lined up for you tonight, with you till 11 o'clock. So much to talk about, as I was just talking to Ro Khan, which is surprising to me that the man, Mr. Chicago, as he's known around here, has never seen Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind. A show, 30 plays in 60 minutes, been going for 30 years. It actually holds the record for the longest late-night fare here in Chicago theater. Greg Allen, who's the founding director, and you may have read about this in the newspapers on the front page of the Sun-Times this week, pulled the licensing from the company, the Neo-Futurist, and the Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind will no longer be in production. It's a sort of a shocking moment, and there's been a lot of infighting since between current and past alumni and Greg about the decision to do so. Greg says it's political. Others say it's political. It's a lot that goes into it. We had Greg on. We were just talking about this. You know, we should go through the interview. We had him on this summer talking about his career in theater. Tonight, we give the floor to three great performers. I'm so happy to get these guys together. Rachel Klaff, Phil Ritterelli, and Dave All. All three spent long swatches of their career at the Neo Futurarium in Andersonville doing that show. Specifically, Dave All is somebody that I remember going to see shows at the Neo Futurarium and being like, I want to do this. You know, he was, tremendous, tremendous talent. Phil Ritterelli, one of the original cast members. Rachel Klaff, all through the 90s. I mean, these are, if you're a fan or in Chicago theater, you know these names. And they're going to be on the program tonight talking about their memories of Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind as it ends on December 31st. So we will have them in studio. Also tonight, how great, the Mystery Science Theater 3000, one of the best programs to ever be on television. Such a simple premise. Evil scientist jettison Joel and his robots into space and force them to watch really bad movies. And they, in the corner of our screen, comment on said movies. Right? Simple premise. But it was a touchstone. I mean, it was a tremendous, tremendous, just lightning rod show. I mean, people loved it when it was on Comedy Central, became a cult classic. Two of the performers from that show, Trace and Frank, will be in studio with us. They're doing a show tomorrow night at the Logan Theater. We'll talk about live riffing movies. That's what they're going to be doing. And really, get, you know, pick their brain about one of the best cult classics in television history. So that's coming up as well. And also Greg Flam's back tonight. Yes, we haven't been on a Thursday in a while. Greg Flam is back with the Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. This is where you call in and tell us about what junk you're proud of. What Chicago junk you're proud of, you know? I told a story. I got this skeleton key that's with me at all times that can open up any lock on the CTA. And it's not worth any money to anybody. Because I'm never giving it up. There was a time I used it more. When I took the L, I would unlock like the empty car, kind of like the driver side and sit in luxury. But I don't take it as much. And I think they've changed the lock since the 90s when I got it. But that's my piece of junk that I will not forget. What is yours? And maybe it's worth something. Greg Flam will be with us in the 10 o'clock hour. 312-981-7200. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I am Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago, starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get to the carryout. Stay with us. All right, so download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11. We've got a great show, so let's kick it off with the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke was in court today for an evidence hearing. Van Dyke has been charged with murder for the shooting of Laquan McDonald. His lawyers and city lawyers are fighting to keep personal emails out of this case, especially ones from Chicago police officers. The judge doesn't seem to agree and scolded the lawyers that they seem to be at odds with the mayor's move to be more transparent. You know, this is a tough issue. I don't know if I'm okay with personal emails from police officers being public record. I know police officers are paid by taxpayers, yada, 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 but we all seem to have a right to private correspondence in our personal lives. The judge said they made an agreement, but they won't publicly share the results. Hypocrite much? Also, who in their right mind would even want to use email after this last election cycle? And now this. If you got something incriminating to say, even like a racist reply all, you may want to just do that like the forefathers did with trained pigeons, right? I think that's where we're going. Donald Trump's cabinet continues to round into form. Today, Trump picked Andy Pudzker, an executive with the company that owns the fast food chain Carl's Jr. He's going to run, ding, 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 the Department of Labor. So hair nets and heat lamps for all. When asked about his philosophy, Pudzker said, hey, if you can lean, you can clean. Now go mop out the fry machine. Come on. Faster. Faster. American military officials say that ISIS has lost 50,000 fighters over a two-year period, killed in battles in both Syria and Iraq. When hearing this news, Trump tweeted, so many jobs lost, sad. I'll bring them back, sad. What are we talking about? Also, it was announced today that Trump is keeping his role as executive producer of the new NBC Celebrity Apprentice. I mean, where else is he going to scout new government talent, right? Supreme Court? Justice Lorenzo Lamas, anyone? The winner of the Celebrity Apprentice, they get to run the Fed. Done. Speaking of the Fed, stocks continue to surge on Wall Street after another record day. Stocks are at the highest level in almost 17 years. Why? Well, some say it may be Trump's signal that he's going to cut regulation and make more business-friendly climates. See, this is how you run the country, Obama. Once you left office, things just started looking up. Oh, wait, he's still in office? You know what? Don't try to trick me with your mumbo-jumbo fake news. He's gone. It was November. Cool? Don't make me barge into your pizzeria. In science news, some are concerned that life expectancy is declining. The average lifespan is now down to 78 years old, which has some concern since it's the lowest number in 23 years. Wait, is this a health concern or the beginning of a bad word problem? 23, 78, how fast is the train going in each direction? 60 miles? In other science news, better science news, Mick Jagger had a kid. Yep, the 73-year-old fathered his eighth child. I don't know what's more startling, Jagger having kids or Jagger having sex, right? Just imagine that same face we've seen dancing around stage. Stop me up! No, seriously, stop me up! I need to start up! In Kanye West news, a source close to the Kardashian family, okay, says that Kim Kardashian wants a divorce and full custody of the kids. The source sold that info to Us Weekly, which is what you do when you're either A, making something up, or B, are confided in, making you the worst person in the world. Then another source told Entertainment Tonight that Kim and Kanye are 100% in love more than ever. Hey, listen, Kanye, Kim, don't let the Jags get you down. I'm with you. I'm with you for the long haul. Just tell me all your secrets. Tell me everything you know. And I promise you I will get top dollar for it. We cool? In weather, oh, it's December 8th. The Weather Mafia is telling us to expect 12 inches of snow in the next week, and temperatures are going to drop to around 0 degrees or negative 600 in the wind chill. I don't know how that works, but something like that. All possible records for this early in December. You got to be kidding me. Come on. Let's all move to Phoenix. Who's with me? Come on. Nobody? In sports, did the Sox do anything today? Come on. I'm addicted to prospects. Rick Hahn, don't take a break. Stay going. Keep going. Trade Frazier, Melky, Abreu, Steve Stone, Kenny Williams. Keep going.
The Bears injury report is out, and guard Josh Sitton participated fully in practice, so he should be back in the starting lineup against the Lions. And corner Kyle Fuller didn't play last week, but he is still on the active roster. So what does that mean? Well, according to Coach John Fox, everything's the same and vanilla, vague, vanilla, monotonous, blah, 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 blah. That's a direct quote. Good news for the 11-10 Bulls. They get Doug McDermott back from injury. He's been out for about a month with a concussion. He suits up, and he's back in action against the Spurs, who haven't lost on the road this year. Come on, Bulls. Prove to us that you can get up for the big games so we can stomach you getting beat by the small games. Cool? I mean, that's a good deal. Don't you think it's a good deal for fans? Beat Cleveland, lose to Milwaukee. We're okay. Aroldis Chapman signed with the Yankees for a ton of money, so let me get this straight. He signed a contract with the Yankees last year, was traded for a ton of Cubs prospects at the deadline, and then this year he signed for more money with the Yankees? Huh. Baseball. Great. And finally, astronaut and American hero John Glenn died today at the age of 95. Glenn was the first American to orbit the Earth, and I thought I was special for being the first person to finish dinner tonight. Well, that's the carryout for December 8th, 2016. Hey, it's so cold out, we're giving you extra napkins with your order, just in case you need to make a makeshift blanket. Coming up, well, we were going to talk to Sebastian Bach, the lead singer of the famed band Skid Row. But you know what? He is the guy who penned the song Youth Gone Wild, and he didn't show. So we'll just talk about the book because I read it. That's it. It's a download 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
So let me get this straight. Yeah. We rent Aroldis Chapman.
Yeah, right?
Comes here, World Series, goes back.
I mean, he's got great agents.
Right?
He got more money, too, didn't he?
See, what? Why doesn't that work for us in radio? Like, I could go, you know, to, like, that all-news station, do an update.
Just for, like, 3 hours and then
just,
come back?
Just, like, work a three-hour, yeah, like, just work a three-hour wheel and then come back.
I feel like at some point or another, and I guess there's really no reason to, but I feel like there'd be some sort of, like, closed loophole at some point. Like, yeah. I feel like Major League Baseball is going to get into winter meetings and be like, you know what Chapman just did? That's not going to, that won't happen anymore. It's too much because you're just renting. I mean, I don't think you could be upset because the Cubs won the World Series.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But they did give up four prospects, like actual human beings in the trade, right? Who are going to, one of the shortstop probably will be on the Yankees roster starting shortstop in a year or two.
Sure.
Just to use Aroldis Chapman for 2 months?
Look, I would, well, I would never, you know, second guess the, no, the brain trust
no,
over there at Wrigley Field. No,
right.
Not at all. But it is interesting. Hey, you know what? The NHL does that as well. I mean, Ray, you know, Ray Bourque goes from Boston.
Right.
He finally wins, you know, so whatever.
It is. Right. It's just so strange. I don't know. I'm not a Yankees fan, but if you were, you'd be like, okay. So we kind of tanked the season and gave him up and got, I guess you'd be happy.
I mean, do you wear your Cubs World Series ring around New York? It's kind of awkward.
He's already melted it down. He's like, I don't care about this. He melted it down for another neck tattoo.
I've got the bling.
But okay. On the other side. All right. Listen to those pipes. Best singer in rock. Listen to this. See, there's just something about that. There's something right there, Sebastian Bach of the band Skid Row. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm just, say it again, Pete Zimmerman with me here, Rob Martier. Coming up, we're going to talk with the Neo-Futurists, some current and past alumni, about the shocking news that Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind no longer be performed at the Neo-Futurarium starting in 2017. It's over licensing. You hate to see that. Like I said, right before the news,
is that for the show tonight, I was very excited that we booked the lead singer of Skid Row, Sebastian Bach, the bad boy of rock and roll, to be on the program tonight because he has a new memoir. And the new memoir, he was going to be at a bookstore this weekend in the Chicago area. So we worked it out, and they were like, well, can we tape, you know, can we do this, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I started reading it, you know, and like I was calling around to different places to get the book and started, you know, just doing like a 24/7 kind of, because we had another book. I forgot what book we had. This is how fast they go. But I had a book, an author in maybe on Monday. And it was a long book. It was like trying to get the whole thing done, or maybe it's Friday. Maybe it's Friday. And so I just started going into this book. I just spent like, 6 hours during the day, and then I'd come to work. So I just had Skid Row on the brain. And of course, you know, he canceled earlier in the week, and then we're going to do it tonight. And then right before the show, we got the call that was like, yeah, he can't do it. Personal emergency. So. And most of the time, I would never do this. Most of the time, and you know this, I mean, it rarely does happen, surprisingly. But we would just book something else. But I just invested 2.5 days in the Skid Row. And I don't know about you guys, but that's like, in real life, that's like 10 weeks. It's a lot of time to put
into
Skid Row.
That's a lot of Skid Row.
And, you know, and I know how the game works. You know, and I totally believe him. It's a personal emergency. But he's coming in.
Yeah, I hope he's okay.
Yeah, but he's coming in to do this book signing this weekend. So, you know, he's not going to offer up an interview to promote a non-existent event, right? So the way it works most of the time is they want to peg to some sort of event, especially if someone who doesn't live in Chicago. And then they come through and we are able to get a couple minutes to talk. So we didn't get it. So, but I was like, well, I read the book. I mean, I'm almost like a Skid Row expert now. It's really interesting. I mean, it is interesting because he's a kid. There's a couple things that came out of this book. If you're familiar, Skid Row was a heavy metal sort of hard rock band from the late 80s. They kind of burst on the scene with a song called 18 in Life, Youth Gone Wild, I Remember You. They were huge on Dial MTV in the late 80s. If you remember the show Dial MTV with Adam Curry, I think it was Adam Curry. It was essentially what became Total Request Live. But it was this idea of a countdown that people could call up and, you know, they would do a top 10 countdown. And at that time on MTV, it was all dominated by hair bands. So it would be Poison or Def Leppard or Aerosmith or Guns N' Roses or Skid Row. And they, when their 18 in Life video came out, it was just number one every night or every day at 5 o'clock after school. I remember being in grade school, I think, at the time, and you would come home and rush to watch MTV, and it would be 18 in Life would be the number one. And, you know, he talks a lot about that time. He also talks about his relationship, which is really interesting to me, his relationship with, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Mostly the drugs part. I mean, he doesn't, he's if you remember Sebastian Bach, he's like a 6'4" pretty boy.
And that, right.
That he gets in a lot of fights because people would say that, because he had that long hair and he almost
very
looked like
lush.
A woman.
Yeah.
And he didn't have the sort of, he didn't have very hard chiseled features. He was very
soft.
And it would get him in trouble because people would, he's living that lifestyle and people would come up and, you know, sort of put him down for it. And the way he would lash out would just to be sort of swing at people. And he'd just get in all these fights. The book is peppered with, I got in a fight and I went to jail. It's like there's no real consequence to the book. It's not like the book is, and that's why I want to talk to him about it. It's not like if you do this, you know, this is the consequence of your life. You know, he says a lot in the book. I was living my dreams, but I was also living a nightmare. And, you know, you can tell by the drug abuse and alcoholism is rampant. I mean, he sort of paints a picture of his life with a microphone in one and a bottle of Jack Daniels in the other.
Yeah, and he's not saying, though, you know, if you do this like I did, boy, you're going to mess up your life.
He actually has a whole chapter in here, which I want to talk about the term rock star being thrown around. You know, because people will say, what a rock star when, you know, Jimmy Butler makes a three-pointer. He's, a, you know, what a rock star basketball player. What a rock star dentist. I think that's a joke he makes, you know, like people living a rock, like being called rock stars when they're not. And there's a big part of being a rock star is truly being a rock star, being authentic. And he talks about he really can't, that bugs him, that he was truly you know, of that sort of rock star mentality, and all these other people are posers.
There are very few rock stars, genuine rock stars. Right.
He's one of them. I mean, I really, whatever you think of the music, I realized listening, I was like, I don't remember being that big of a Skid Row fan. And I think that's why I chose tonight to talk about it, and even though he blew us off. Because, you know, I spent a lot of time on something that I wasn't necessarily passionate about. It's not like it was joyful reading. And I don't know, knock on the book. But it wasn't like I was like, oh, man, I can't wait to read about my favorite band, Skid Row. You know, I'm interested in the guy because he was a – and they kind of touch on this in the book, too. He was a bad boy, meaning that was what they marketed him as. Like, you don't want to get too close to your daughter. This guy's got, you know, one thing on his mind, and it's hard rocking. Yeah! And he lived up to it, and he kind of talks about this strange dichotomy or I guess, contrast of that's not who he was, but that's how he was marketed. So he almost plays to the role.
So as a character, he's essentially playing.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that, you know, he lived his life that way. But he was a there's something to be said. He has this whole thought about life imitates art, that more often than not, he found himself actually the things he was singing about or, you know, as he talked about in Broadway, he was in Jekyll and Hyde. A lot of the words that he said almost always came true, and vice versa. Like the things that he did became art later. And that's something that he just always felt was really spooky. That's how he kind of writes about it. So, and then there's what we'll do is we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and I'll read a passage because he talks about Alpine Valley in Chicago. I had a lot to talk to him
skiing?
About.
Skiing? Was he skiing?
It was not skiing. Hmm. Here's what I had on my notes. You like this, Pete. This is what I had. Musical influences, Kiss. He met his dad took him to see Kiss. That's what got him started.
That's a good influence.
And it's also it's also shared, meaning, you know, you hear that story and he relays the story that's similar to a lot of those guys from the time in the late 80s, the guys who were fronting bands like Poison, Guns N' Roses. They were all like influenced by Kiss. Art imitates life. Alpine Valley.
Also wears makeup.
He also wears makeup. That's right. His time on Broadway, which I think was a strange time, his bad boy stuff, the authenticity, and then his voice technique. Because I do think that truly he was one of the more pure kind of rock and roll singers. He had that do that. And, you know, there were some times in his career where he blew out his voice and, you know, he was working on records, things like that. So that's what I was going to talk to him about. So we'll take a break and I'll read a passage from the book. And if you have any questions about from the unofficial biographer, me, who just read Sebastian Bach's book. So essentially, as I say with the carryout, I read the news. I read Sebastian Bach's book, so you don't have to. And I did. I did it over 2 days' time. I can tell you anything you need to know. 312-981-7200. Ricky was a young boy. He had a heart of stone. Lived not too far. Listen to that right there. The engine down. Like a switchblade set, so one could take him down. Oh. Little Skid Row here on the Download 720 WGN. We're playing because Sebastian Bach was supposed to be our guest tonight, and the longtime singer, Broadway star, and now author had a personal emergency and canceled tonight. He's going to be in Chicago this weekend for book signing. So I kind of know the only reason we didn't reschedule and not talk about it is we kind of know the writing's on the wall that we're not going to get a chance to talk to Sebastian Bach, which is a bummer because I just read 390 pages of stories. 630 says, saw him in Alpine Valley. Headliner was Bon Jovi. It was awesome. There's a lot about that tour in this book. You would like it, including the last show of the tour where John Bon Jovi and Sebastian Bach get into a big fight, and John Bon Jovi's dad allegedly chokes Sebastian Bach against the wall. A lot of Sebastian Bach's stories end up with him getting shoved up against a wall and someone going, I don't know what to do with you. Here's how he starts the book. He's got a sultry look on the cover of this book, but it says, Youth Gone Wild. This is the prologue. I touch my fingers to my lips. I stand, bathed in sweat, in the center of the stage. The taste is salty to the tongue. I look at the ground. I see a glass bottle under my gaze, lying askew atop the metal grid. I feel the red liquid all over my hand. I touch the crimson substance to my mouth. I wipe my brow. I discover that my face is completely covered in what I'm assuming is tomato juice. To my shock, horror, and amazement, my face is not covered in tomato juice. My face is completely covered in my own blood. In front of 20,000 people, opening for my heroes, Aerosmith. I see red, not from the blood in my eyes, but from the anger in my heart. General admission crowds are they're by nature, they're crazy. When there are no chairs at a concert and thousands of people crush into one sweaty, rocking crowd, things can get out of control all too easily. I look into the seething mass of highly charged rock and rollers on the arena floor in front of me. I start to utter the infamous rap, as viewed millions of times now on YouTube. About 10 guys circle one guy. They're all pointing at him. They're all shouting at me. It was him! It was him! Was it you? Expletive. The man in the middle, he says nothing. He looks straight at me and extends his middle finger, a gesture commonly known as the middle finger. What happens next is the first chink in the armor of Skid Row, of stardom. This is the exact moment when my childhood dream shows the first sign of an adult nightmare. I had spent 7 or 8 years previous to this moment playing in clubs, bars, saloons, playing 3 sets a night, cover tunes to drunk rock and rollers in Quebec and Northern Ontario. Fighting was just part of the scene that I had been in for years now. I did not know any way to respond, but this was not a club. This was a packed arena. Anyway, 3 more pages of how this was the infamous where he jumped in and he punched and he kicked a guy right in the face and he threw a bottle back and he broke somebody's nose. He was arrested and thrown in jail, blah, blah, blah. There's 6 pages more of this. And then he says, as I thought of the bottle crushing into a fan's face thrown by me, I hung my bloody head in shame in the back of a police car and wept. All I ever wanted to do was entertain people with music, with singing, with my voice. I have never in my life ever tried to be a, quote, bad boy. All I ever tried to be is good. The doors of my jail cell clinked shut that night with a resounding thud. I sat in my cell and pondered the severity of my actions, the irony of my circumstance. We are the youth gone wild, indeed, but at what cost? Guitar solo. So it's a lot of stories like that, sort of punctuated with drug use, Jack Daniels, and hanging out with Guns N' Roses. That's essentially it. 350 pages of, then I was hanging out with Axl Rose. Then I was hanging out with Vince Neil. Then I was hanging out with the guys from Aerosmith. Like, it's just like that. They were mad at me. They were mad at me. It's a common refrain. Yes, they don't like me anymore. So Sebastian Bach with his new memoir. We didn't get a chance to talk to him tonight, but it's worth a read. I don't think you should power read it the way I did it for a set. I really, truly, Pete, and you know this because I've been bothering you about it. I like had to set a timer essentially, like I need to get through this because we're interviewing Sebastian Bach and I want to do it right. And I read 380 pages in 2 days. And I now consider myself an expert. An unauthorized biographer of the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Sebastian Bach. Welcome back here to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Thank you so much. All the texters are like, you just keep continuing to read from Sebastian Bach's book. It's the real classic radio. It really is. I think we're on to something. It took years, but I think we found our breakout hit. Maybe it's something the Neo Futurists could look into to replace Too Much Light. Last week, news broke that the Neo Futurist Theater Company no longer had the license to perform Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind for 2017. The late-night show that attempted to perform 30 plays in 60 minutes is owned by founding director Greg Allen. Allen chose to end the agreement and in a statement said he wanted to start anew with a new cast and company and use the show to take on fascism, take on Donald Trump. The show was the longest-running late-night theater in Chicago history, dating back to 1988. In that time, the Neo-Futurists did something that so many other companies tried to replicate. They became a viral sensation. Yep, live theater that just had to be seen. A rites of passage, a Chicago tradition. It's hard to think of Chicago without Too Much Light. It's a show that introduced thousands to the theater. Diverse social views. And, well, to a community of like-minded young people that were all trying to make Chicago home. And the amount of talent that's come through those doors, it's astounding. So many great, respected professionals that took their job seriously and inspired so many people to be creative, follow their dreams, and, well, do something. I have three of those people in studio tonight. Dave Aull, Phil Ritterelli, and Rachel Claff. Phil Ritterelli was one of the first ensemble members back in the late 80s to do Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind. And you've That's been right. in and out for years. And mm-hmm. was it last year you were still doing the show?
Yeah, I was active as recently as last year doing Too Much Light. Back in the day, I would do Too Much Light and then a primetime show before that. These days, I'm like, you know what? Just one or the other. So the last thing I did was Trust Us, Screw You with Dan Kerr-Hobert, our show about confidence men.
And, all right. And joining shortly thereafter, after Phil started in 1988, is our next panelist, Dave Aull. Dave, I mean, you were there for over a decade. I mean, essentially the 90s you were at Neo-Futurist. And really
right.
the shows that I saw, that was you. You were
Yeah,
you
I was like the Chandler Bing of Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. I was just around for the 90s and then kind of disappeared. So.
And also joining us, Rachel Clash. She came to the company in the mid-90s, and she is still active. She produces the show It Came from the Neo-Futurarium at the Neo-Futurist. Rachel, great to see you again.
Me too.
You're just in here.
Yes.
You know, this has been such – I told my audience this earlier that, you know, I spent the last 2 days really getting deep in the Sebastian Bach book. But it was – whenever I had to take a break, I came up for air to read stories about this the end of Too Much Light. Yeah. For you guys, I mean, to be part of this show that was on stage for 30 years – Talk about the emotion that's you're going through this week as this is all unfolding in public.
It's been a roller coaster. I got to be honest with you. You know, we're not all together the way we used to be because of the show. So we've been sharing memories and feelings online together and face to face when we can. I'll tell you what. So December is traditionally the anniversary shows, the best of shows, when the Neos do a retrospective of all their favorite and popular and topical plays from the year. So last Friday, so the news broke middle of last week,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And then Friday, the turnout to that show was really overwhelming. I'm not talking about the line was around the block, and there were people out there at like 9 o'clock, and that was great. But the Neos from past years who showed up, it was the first and really only opportunity we had to show our support for the active ensemble member. And they were all there, as well as John Pearson and Lisa Biscani, who are alums who had performed throughout this year.
Yeah.
So it was a huge celebration. And I've never seen a standing ovation before the show.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, you know, I saw the show this past weekend, Sunday night, and I've been seeing the show since 1989, early in 89, the very first year. So I have 28 years of Too Much Light watching, sometimes as a cast member, but actually more amount of time not. And I will say that I think this current iteration of the cast is really strong. I was really impressed. There were a number of people who I had not seen perform before, and they unleashed a brand of nonlinear, irrational comic insanity that I was just really proud that this is where, you know, Too Much Light Chicago ended up. So here's my metaphor for what the last week or so has been like emotionally. The Chicago Neo-Futurists have basically been living with an unexploded bomb in our front yard for 28 years. And we always knew that this thing could go off. We always knew that this thing could happen, that a certain someone could decide that he didn't want to play with the group anymore and he was going to take his bat and his ball and go blah, blah, blah. So on some level, there was some preparation for it, but you're never really prepared for an explosion like that. But what comes after all the turmoil and the blood and the screaming and the helicopters and the sirens and everything else that we went through when the news broke is gradually this feeling of kind of relief, because the thing that's been hanging over your head all this time has happened, and now you're living in the post-apocalyptic reality, and you know, you get to kind of create the new world. So what I want to say to, you know, everyone out there in Radio Land who's been reading that Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind is closing, well, that's true, but what you got to know is the Neo-Futurists, this amazingly strong lineup, they're still going to be there at the Neo-Futurarium Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights in the same time slots. And some little things are going to change. The title of the show is going to change. They may have to make some changes to the structure. But you're still going to see that same brilliant cast performing short neo-futurist plays, same writer-performers you love, same mix of poetry and comedy and surrealism and politics. So, you know what? It's still there. It's just going to be a different name.
Rachel, there is something to be said about, you know, you could take the words away. I mean, you could take the names away from these shows, but it's a spirit that moves a theater company. Your experience over the last week of dealing with this this news.
No, that's pretty accurate. I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, what's come out of it for me, same as Phil, is just that remembering the community part of it that has been so powerful. I mean, I always sort of said in my tenure with the Near Futurists that it's like being married to about 18 people. You frequently want to murder them, but you also love them and you have their back no matter what. And I think that came back in full force this week. And I've talked to people who I haven't talked to in a while. I've talked to, you know, my best friends who came out of the ensemble, you know, and it's just the outpouring. Like Phil said, going to the show on Friday night and seeing the love in that room was astonishing. And seeing the enthusiasm with which the current cast embrace this challenge is really, I don't fear for them at all. They are going to be just fine because the show was and is as strong as the people performing it. It always has been.
We've been hearing from, obviously, we have an opportunity for ensemble members to get back in touch and reminisce and check in and how you're doing and support each other. But I've been hearing from people who are my friends now who were audience members for decades.
Yes.
Coming for decades and decades. And the same is true of people who come now to see the folks in the active ensemble. You don't come to see the clothesline. You don't come to see the things that the darkroom timer, whatever it is.
The dice.
You're coming because, you know, it's affordable, sure, but you're coming because you relate to what the people are saying on stage.
That's
it's
right.
And the overall experience. Right?
Yeah.
Or what I always say is, you might come the first time because you heard, oh, they roll dice for what you pay, and they have this clothesline.
Yeah.
That's why you come the first time. But we had people all through the 90s, and it's true, the people who show up every week, and they're there in the front row, and they just love this show. And those people are only coming back again and again because the writing is so strong.
Well, let's do this.
They become your friends.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break and let's start at the beginning. I want to talk about, you know, your recollections of starting as a neo-futurist in the ensemble on the show, and also take us through what this show was setting out to do and if it accomplished it. Phil Ritterelli, Dave Aul, Rachel Claff in studio talking about Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind, the longest running late night theater show in Chicago, which is closing on December 31st, 2016. We'll continue the conversation here on The Download right after the break. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, three members, past and present, of the Neo-Futurists and cast members of Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, a show which is it's shocking to see it on the front page of the Sun-Times. It really is, and we've known each other for a long time. But, I mean, you think of all the shows that you've done that have just been groundbreaking for the city, you know, for the lines around the corner at the Neo-Futurists in Andersonville, and the end of it is what, you know, it gets up on the front page of the paper. That's how it works, right? Phil Ritterelli, Dave Aul, and Rachel Claff in studio. So I'm fascinated, guys. Phil, let's start here. You know, talk about the first ensemble. Like, what is Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind?
It is an ever-changing attempt to perform 30 plays in 60 minutes. And the plays, the thing about the plays is they're not, and I, you know, you've got kind of constantly remind people it's not improv. It's not, you know, there are elements of spontaneity, you know, in the show, but They're scripted pieces in which the performers and the background of the performers are, you know, writers, improvisers, musicians, directors, playwrights, poets.
Poets, yeah.
I got it. I had to look around the table. But that they don't play characters and they don't pretend to be. There's no illusion. You know, there's no fourth wall. We're all in the room together trying to accomplish these specific tasks.
And they're not skits either, or sketches.
Rachel, the experience we kind of talked about, the kind of throughout the thing about the dice and the name tags, but there really is, beyond just what's on stage, there's an experience that's sort of displayed at the Neo-Futurarium.
Yeah, I mean, people always, it's interesting because one of the things I've heard over and over, and in fact it became sort of an internet, before there were memes, I think it was a meme, that oh, you know you're a Chicagoan when you see too much light and you think, I could do that. And it kind of became this thing of, you look at it and you go, that doesn't look that hard. You just get up there and talk. But it is hard, and I think everybody will here at this table will back me up. It is really intense, and you know, our week would look like you'd go in and on Tuesday, you'd have written content, you pitch your content, everybody goes around the table, votes for the plays they want to put in the show. We then rehearse for, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours tops.
Because there's new material at the end at the end of the show. You roll a dice and whatever number comes out
on Friday, Saturday evening, sum of those two rolls is how many new plays go in.
That's
so
right. So anywhere, we rehearse on Tuesdays, and then you'd be on the honor system until Friday to learn your lines, get your props, get ready, and then we'd have about an hour, I think an hour and a half or 2 hours before the show went up, and you'd go, and the show was at 11:30 at night.
There's so much discipline that goes into that. And to think about this being a theater company, especially in the early days, Dave, I mean, the idea that there's no money going around, this is what you're doing at night. I mean, you really are dedicating yourself to this craft and coming up with new material every single week.
I have to say, Fridays are grueling if you're in the Neo Future. Like in the early 90s, I had my first job as a professional copywriter at the Sears catalog. And, you know, I'd have to be there at like 8 a.m. and, you know, work this day and then, you know, take the bus back into the city and try to get, you know, what we called in those days a disco nap, but also learn my lines and do all this stuff so I could be at the theater by 9:30, rush through rehearsals, and then, you know, do the show that gets over at 1 or 1:30 in the morning. You know, get home about 2, maybe get to sleep about 4 a.m. And that, you know, trying to do that at the same time that you were working a regular job where you had to be, you know, at work at 8 or 9 in the morning, it was a killer. And sometimes, as Phil was alluding, we would do primetime shows too. So you'd go from your job to the theater and do a show at 8 o'clock and then do Too Much Light at midnight. Stamina, boy.
But here's the thing is, what was always the constant was that you were always writing. And nowadays, because the people in the show come from so many different disciplines, they're choreographing something. You've got to learn choreography, and you've got to learn a song, and you've got to learn your monologue, and you've got to write these things. So you're writing things about what's going on in current events, what's affecting me personally. I'm telling you.
Is it different for you? I mean, from 1989 to being in the cast last year, I mean, is there a difference to the show that you perform in?
The people. I mean,
I'd say there's a difference almost every year.
Yeah, I mean, the subject matter, the way the subject matter is approached.
Mm-hmm. The musical reference points. Boy, generationally, you see new generations come in and there's a new kind. Because, you know, one of the perks of being in the show is you get to work your music into the plays.
Yeah, right.
It's also, I mean, it's gotten, there are... Again, clowns and filmmakers and poets involved. So it's. I think it's a little bit more abstract than it had been in the past, yeah. Which is fantastic. It's fantastic to see.
We're talking about the longest late night running theater show in Chicago. Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind, which is ending. In this way that as you said, Dave, I mean, you kind of knew there was a ticking time bomb on the front lawn. There's strife. We're not going to get into the strife around this, but it's ending in a way that isn't necessarily fitting for what the show did for Chicago for 30 years. It's just kind of like, boom.
You know what I want to say, at least for the Doctor Who fans out there, the show isn't dying, it's regenerating.
Yeah,
it's going to have a new face, you know, but it's going to be the same old thing with a slightly different appearance.
Well, here's what we'll do. Let's take a quick break, and we'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. We'll talk more. I want to get at the counterculture part of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really thought at the time when I saw the show 1992, 1993, that I was like, this is – nobody's talking about the issues that are in these plays. Nobody's talking about the – I mean, it's very eye-opening kind of experience to be in a theater in Chicago being like, wow, this is real. I want to talk about that. And I also want to hear – you know, we can actually do a play. You guys want to do a play?
Yeah, absolutely.
Rachel Claff, Dave Aull, Phil Ritterelli in studio. We're talking Too Much Light here on The Download tonight. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's The Download with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we are going to talk with Frank and Trace from Mystery Science Theater 3000, the Comedy Central sci-fi program, which was all through the 90s. Both those guys, they play big roles in the show. They are riffing on live movies at the Logan Theater tomorrow night. So they are going to be in studio to talk about
it. I know where I'll be.
Phil Ritterelli, Dave Aull, and Rachel Claff in studio. This hour, as we talk about the show Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, which is ending after being the longest-running late-night show in Chicago history. It is ending December 31st after essentially a licensing dispute. The founding director is pulling the licensing, deciding to start fresh. And it's really brought up a lot of emotion, not just with the neo-futurists, but with the theater community and I think audiences at large who a lot of our – I mean, Anna DeVlantis and I were talking about how she went when she was in high school. I remember being one of the first things I did when I went to Columbia College was come up and see – Pete Zimmerman was saying the same thing when he was in college. So, I mean, there's just this connection to the show. Talk about that. Talk about that. There are so many young people because truly Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind – it's something that young people can do.
Yep,
absolutely. And I think the other thing that really strikes me is how democratic maybe is the right word for the show, but it's also for the audience. I think we often sort of talked about that atmosphere that happens during the show, that you walk in and you feel like all the rules have gone out the window because it's not like any show you're ever going to see. And right away, you're thrown into sort of chaos with, you know, you roll a die to pay for them. It's random. You pay for your ticket, you know, with the roll of a die. You then are go in and somebody's sitting there with headphones on and sunglasses listening to music and says, "Hi, what's your name?" And whatever they hear you say or think they hear you say, they put on a name tag. You slap on a name tag and you go inside, and already you're going, "What is this?" And people are, you know, shouting and talking, and the cast is right there talking to you. And I think it is really immediate and exciting. I think the mission statement even says, you know, it's a fusion of sport, poetry, and live newspaper.
And it does. I think, you know, as we were kind of talking in the break, just this idea of so many people have probably said throughout their time, you know, "I'm not really much in the theater, but you guys I like." I mean, there's something right. about yeah. what turning the whole concept, turning the whole concept of a theatrical experience on its
yeah.
head.
Yeah, it's random. It's participatory. You don't the house lights don't go down. You don't get to disappear as an audience member. You got to be active and engaged for an hour. And it turns out people like that. And like I said, you're revealing the performers are revealing themselves. It's not that you're going to see All My Sons for, you know, 3 right, hours right. to come away with one theme. You've actually learning. There are 30 different ideas that are all, you know, squeezed together in this 60 minutes.
Now, Dave, I mentioned right before the break, I mean, one of the things that I really enjoyed about countless times that I've seen Too Much Light has been the political and social POV. I mean, there is something special about not only, you know, turning theater experience on its head, but then also having strong points of view and really challenging the status quo and doing so in a way that's just smart and creative. There's just something about the issues that are happening in our society done by the neo-futurists.
Yeah, I might shock you right now when I say when I moved to Chicago, my plan was to do stand-up.
Really?
And I went to the comedy clubs downtown, and it was just not the right era in comedy for me because I saw a lot of homophobic stuff, a lot of sexist stuff. It was the heyday of like Sam Kinison and Andrew Dice Clay. Yeah. And I don't see myself fitting in here. And then I went and saw the neo-futurists because my good college friend Lisa Biscani had gotten cast and she kind of ordered me to come see her in the show. And I blew me away because they were feminist, they were progressive, they were, you know, challenging, you know, militarism. They were
Play form. That's what, like, in short plays. Yeah, that's what was so brilliant about it.
I connect with these people. Plus, it was that mix of the comedy and the poetry and the politics and the personal revelation. And just, you know, like you were talking about before, people look at that and you immediately get it and go, oh, I want to do that. And my sneaky thing that I did, I always say I kind of Eve Harrington'd my way into the cast.
That's true.
I started writing Little Too Much Light plays and I gave them to Lisa. And she would take them into rehearsal and pitched them, and a few of my pieces got into the show over the course of 1989. So I am the only neo-futurist who actually
You're
wrote for the
writer.
Show before I was
in it.
And that gave me a little leg up when it came time to audition.
Rachel, do you remember, I mean, you must, but do you remember your audition about the experience of trying to get into
this
cast?
I do. I mean, I was kind of a groupie before I came in, and I had done a workshop. I had done a Too Much Light workshop. So I transitioned straight out of the workshop into the audition because they just happened to be at the same sort of time. I was 23. I had just moved to Chicago. And like Dave, I came here to do a very different thing. I came to be an actress with a capital A, right? So I auditioned for the big guns. My first job was at the Goodman, and it was all well and good, but there was something missing for me. I had been a writer before I was a performer, and I felt like I don't want to read other people's words. I don't want to be told that I'm not this or not that enough to be on stage. Mm-hmm. That's insane. I have this tool that I want to use, and I want my voice to be heard, and I want it to be heard in a way that, you know, is powerful and my own. I had and to see that show and say, you know, have that same experience. Oh my God, I could have agency here. And it was, and it, like Dave, it was this incredible mix of people speaking their truths unapologetically with incredible risk. And that just was, I was hooked.
And what's wonderful is that the folks who are active now are really, really good at teaching a lot of workshops to give even more and more people opportunity. And rather than just seeing the show and hoping that you can audition,
there's a process.
There's a process involved that they've been sharing for years now, and just creating so many more opportunities for people to become their own sort of artists in the city. And
I've taught a lot of those workshops, and I can say every time that the look on someone's face when they realize that they can write a monologue or a piece and perform it and be heard is really
That's
intense.
Awesome, yeah.
And it can be anyone. It doesn't have to be an actor. It doesn't have to be a performer.
And also, it's nice in the neo-futurist format. You don't have to split your being. Like, if you're going to be a
That's
comedian,
right.
there's the pressure to always get a laugh. If you're going to be a poet, that's something different. In the neo-futurist world, you can be funny, or you can be poetic, or you can be angry, or you get the full range of emotions, and whatever's on your mind that week, you can present
there's
a place for it in the show.
And there's something really great about the ability in an ensemble to write as sort of as fast as you are with little sort of collaborative editing, meaning, you know, I've worked in sessions where there's six or seven people and you want to put something together and a lot of people moving stuff here and moving stuff there, and the next thing you know, it's not what you wanted to say. There's something about the neo-futurist and Too Much Light because of the time that it takes to put this stuff on that you're like, Phil, whatever you got to say, say it.
On Tuesday nights after we select the plays and you get up on your feet, the author is
the director
of that piece. Yeah. And there's a lot of respect for, this is your vision. I'm going to help you present it as clearly as we can. But it's your vision and it's your hands, and run with it.
Phil, I got to ask you, as one of the original, I mean, we're talking about Stage Left. We're talking about that Belmont and Clark,
Live Bait.
Just that sort of counterculture time in the late 80s when you had a Voltaire and other places that were doing that kind of stuff right there. I mean, that there was something special about what you guys were trying to put together.
Well, you know, in the same way that the people in the show now are responding to things that are happening in the world and the politics and the election we talk about, that's all we were doing, right? We were responding to exactly what was going on. And it's so wonderful to see how the plays have changed. The feeling has remained the same and the approach has remained the same, but the content and what's being said and how it's being said continues to change. But, you know, you got to remember, right around the corner, like Annoyance opened up around the corner. Mm-hmm. And like I said, at that time, 10:30, theater's like, good night. They shut the doors and that was it.
The city did.
Yeah, right. The idea of like coming to theater at 11:30 at night,
There was this wonderful fringe scene that blossomed in Chicago in the late 80s, early 90s. Theater Oobleck, our big, you know, contemporaries of ours. Also,
Curious.
Cardiff Giant, where Greg Kotis came to us from.
And Scott.
All of these wonderful groups. And I always say it's because in those days, space was so cheap in Chicago. You could, above and beyond theater spaces, you could go to these different like bars and saloons and just say, hey, you know, can we have an idea for a show. Can we do it here? And we'll give you a cut of the door. Or they'd say, don't even worry if you bring in enough people and they order it. So whatever crazy vision you had for theater, you could find a space to do it.
Yeah.
And all of this wonderful stuff that came out of Chicago in the 90s, I think came from that.
Do you think that? Do you think it's harder to do that now in 2016?
Oh yeah, it's so much more expensive. To
it's
find
still
a
possible
space.
Though when you compare it to other cities. I think that's
yes.
But you're right.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, I think
yes.
people
yes.
are. Listen, you know, it may not be smack dab in the middle of Lakeview, but there's stuff going on in Pilsen and the South Side and the South Loop that's exciting, and people are finding they're making their own opportunities.
Phil Ritterelli, Dave All, Rachel Claff in studio. We're talking about Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind, which is wrapping up the longest run in Chicago history, late night run in Chicago history, on December 31st. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk some more. Stay with us.
Here we go.
Neo-Futurists, Phil Ritterelli, Dave All, Rachel Claff in studio. We're talking about Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. You know, as we wrap up here, and we only have about, you know, 10 minutes left, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask for you guys to perform something. You guys have come with some of the books and scripts. I feel like it's Tuesday night at the old Nietzsche.
Pitching our play.
I should point out, too, that as of the closing, they will have done 9,775 plays.
Ooh, so close.
And some of these plays, and one of the things that's great about it, some of these plays could be 5 to 10 minutes long. Others are 5 seconds.
Oh, no, 10 minutes.
No,
you get in trouble.
I'll
dare
you. 5 or 6, though.
Four minutes, I think, is as long as you're allowed to go before.
I think you guys should have pushed it, gone for like a 20-minute.
If you've been in the show for 27 years, they're like, we'll let Phil do his 3-minute play.
Fine.
Great,
all right,
Phil.
All right, what are we going to hear here?
We're going to do a play from 1994, and I'll set that. We were talking a little about issues in the show. For me, as a gay person, one of the cool things about Too Much Light, it was still in those days pretty rare to have openly gay performers. I mean, this was before Ellen came out. And Too Much Light was a show where I could be openly gay on stage and supported by my straight compatriots. I wanted to make it my issue to kind of out myself in every show because I wanted everyone who came into the theater to kind of feel like they'd met a gay person if they didn't have any gay friends. And I wanted the high school kids who were gay and thinking about coming out to have seen a gay person performing with their supportive straight friends. And so this is one of those plays. This is from 1994. This is called, well, Phil's gonna call.
Shall we begin? All right. Theater chat, go.
Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Rachel.
And this is Theater Chat.
Welcome to Theater Chat for December 8th, 2016.
Today our topic is one that I personally find fascinating because it's very close to my own heart. We're going to be talking about heterosexuals in the theater.
Oh my God, there are a lot of heterosexuals in the theater, aren't there?
You can't hardly walk into a dressing room without tripping over one of them. You know, Rachel, over my many years in the theater, I have made dozens of wonderful heterosexual friends. It was in the theater that I first encountered heterosexuals.
Oh my God, I know. My college theater department was full of them. And, you know, I was a little uncomfortable around them at first until I came to see how really charming they can be.
Definitely.
I mean, regardless of what you think of their lifestyle, you can't deny that they tend to be very talented people and often very witty.
Oh, they're awfully entertaining. I mean, I wouldn't want to go to a party where there wasn't at least one of them
holding court the way they do.
Oh, I know. I mean, it seems like they can all sing or dance or do impressions or something.
And they don't all try to hit on you.
No, most of them are very polite. You just say no, and they usually respect that.
Well, anyway, we're talking about heterosexuals in the theater.
Right. And first off, we should probably point out that there have been many great playwrights who were, in fact, heterosexual.
Right.
Like, for instance,
Like for instance,
Neil Simon.
Oh, of course, Neil Simon. And you know, you can really get a sense from reading his plays that he's a heterosexual too.
Well, it does tend to creep into their work, doesn't it?
Certainly. Just look at Barefoot in the Park. There was that relationship between Carrie or Laurie or whatever, and that man,
Robert Redford.
Oh, right, Robert Redford.
Oh, and what about the Star Spangled Girl?
I mean, gosh, the title gives it away right there, doesn't it?
Wait, what's that? Really? Oh, ladies and gentlemen, I have something really exciting to announce. For the first time in the history of Theater Chat, we seem to have gotten a telephone call. Well, actually, it's just Phil pretending to be a telephone call, but still, it's very exciting.
Hello, caller.
Hi, yeah, I'm just calling in to say that I am sick and tired of hearing about heterosexuals. I turn on the TV, I turn on the radio, it's all you hear about. I mean, what if a child heard this show?
Well, now.
And another thing, I don't think you'd keep harping on this subject all the time if you weren't harboring some heterosexual feelings of your own. Admit it, Dave, I bet you're secretly heterosexual yourself, aren't you?
Well, that's the first time I've ever been accused of that. But for the record, neither Rachel nor I... Rachel? Rachel?
Oh my God, Dave, help me.
Oh, Rachel, have you been having some heterosexual feelings?
I'm just so confused.
Oh, honey, really, it's no big deal. Listen, there are special neighborhoods where you can live and nobody will even notice. Like Schaumburg.
Oh.
Hey, let's talk about this some more later, okay?
Okay.
Well, that's all for this theater chat. So till next time, remember, be careful what you say, because heterosexuals really are everywhere. Good night.
Curtain. There you are.
Dave All, Rachel Claff, and Phil Ritterelli from the Neo-Futurist, Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind. The big news this week that the show is wrapping up December 31st over a licensing drama.
And then being reborn.
And then regenerating, as you said.
Yes.
Let me ask, I mean, what is next? I mean, the theater has to be prepared for this, obviously, and they're ready. They're not, the Neo-Futurists are not closing. They're not folding. No, they've already came out and said, we've got other programming. Yeah, what's next for the company?
There's going to be a new iteration of this performance, Fridays and Saturdays at 11:30, Sundays at 7. That'll be starting up in January, and they're working hard on it right now. And they've had some things in the work for a while that people should be looking forward to. There is a show that they've been running for a year and a half now called The Arrow, which is a different sort of iteration of storytelling. It's storytelling supported by an ensemble. The ensemble keeps changing. It's really, really exciting. In fact, I don't know if I've had a chance to talk to you guys about this, but it truly reminds me of what the first few months of Too Much Light was.
Oh.
It was spontaneous. It was people who were intimate with each other's experience and story and different methods of storytelling. And there's a workshop coming up. I'm going to get this. Next Wednesday on the 14th for a show they're doing called Tangles and Plaques about death.
Let
and
me
memory.
Ask you this, yeah. as we wrap up. I mean, I don't think it's possible for anyone who's listening right now to see the final shows of Too Much Like.
No, they're sold out.
They're all sold out,
well,
right?
They haven't. So there are advanced ticket sales online. But they only sell part of the audience, so you can still get in line early for the best
I
of shows.
I will match anyone out there if they want to stand in line together.
And then are we allowed to tease this on January 1st?
We're only allowed to hint it.
Actually, hint at it.
You did not just say that date, because
okay,
we're
sorry,
not allowed to hint at the date.
No
so
hints,
everyone,
hint.
Take a pill and forget you just heard that date. But imagine for a minute that all these wonderfully talented people we were talking about who've been in Too Much Light over the years, not all of them, but if a lot of them decided they wanted to make a show of force statement
sequence,
in favor
right.
of yeah. Too Much right. in favor of the Neo-Futurist
wow,
Chicago
I would like
company
to see that.
What if they all came together right. and did something
yeah. huh. We'll see.
Hogwash. I don't think it can be done.
Pipe dream.
You know, the last question for you guys, just quickly as we wrap up before the news, you guys were a part of an institution and a show that broke records here in town. Mm-hmm. It also had a huge impact on the people who saw it, from high school kids to people who continue to stand in line today. What's it mean to you to be a part of this show?
Oh, everything. I mean, it's a huge part of my life. Decades, 28 years, half my life. Incredibly proud to be a part of it. And to have met some and worked with so many of those people throughout those decades, it's almost every opportunity I've had in the arts has come out of that show.
Rachel?
For me, it's two things. I mean, when I joined at age 23, so I can safely say that being in the company shaped the artist that I am today, taught me how to write better, how to perform better, how to be a better woman, actually. I had mentor after mentor there, and it also gave me the best friends of my life. I mean, some of them, you know, have married each other and had children. So, you know, this is family. And the other thing for me is that it truly taught me how to fail and not be afraid of failing, because you get up there on Friday and if something goes badly, you're on to the next play. As Scott Herms, one of our alumni, said, if we suck, we suck short. You just go on to the next thing and you learn not to take it seriously.
All right. Yeah. Final word, Dave.
It really was the 10 best years of my creative life, because you get to experiment and just try so many things. And the quality of the artists that I got to collaborate with, I feel like I just lucked into this incredible experience. And everyone who stumbles into our theater probably feels like they lucked into something. Mm-hmm.
Chicago theater legends, Phil Ritterelli, Dave Hall, Rachel Claff, Too Much Light Makes
See
a Baby
Go Blind.
See you in
January.
It's
a Neo.
Yeah,
that's right. There you go. Good to see you guys. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNradio.com. Great to have those guys in the studio, huh? I mean, it's funny. I think back to Dave and telling stories about, and Phil too, like sitting on the floor in those shows, being like, oh, halfway through with my date that I brought, you know, from DePaul. Some girl I met from DePaul. Be like, you want to come see some shows?
Yeah, but it was those UIC girls.
Yeah, the UIC girls had already seen the show. It was the DePaul girls that were always like, what? And I'm like, let me take you to Andersonville. Okay, it's a little out of the way. You want to know Chicago, follow me. And I take and we sit on the floor, and they're like, why are we sitting on the floor? I'm like, it is a thing. Why did we roll a die? You know what? DePaul, just go with the flow. Anyway, we've been married ever since. No, that's not true. All right, coming up, this is great. Trace and Frank from Mystery Science Theater 3000 will be in studio. They're the Mads. They're going to be at the Logan Theater tomorrow night for two shows. They're going to be riffing off two movies. We'll talk about that coming up. It's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with Download. We're here till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Greg Flamm joins us for the swap meet. We did it every Thursday night, where you call in with your what's so impressive about your Chicago junk. It's essentially the segment. That's the segment. And yeah, not that junk, a different junk. A lot of people call in and they will say, well, you know what? I have the poster for when the Pope came to Chicago. That's like a standby. Mm-hmm. Like from 1977, 1978, the Pope came through Chicago.
It's like a Farrah Fawcett poster.
Yeah. It's like a pinup kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's a fun segment. Call in, tell us what you have. And then Greg Flamm, who is he really goes from flea markets to flea markets, will tell you if it's worth anything. A lot of times it's worth nothing. But it's sort of like Antique Roadshow meets Chicago junk.
Wow.
So there you go.
That sounds great.
That's coming up at 10 o'clock. All right. Well, tomorrow night, the Logan Theater in Logan Square will host a special show featuring two comedians who may be better known to the world as the Mads. Trace Belew and Frank Conniff are two of the brains behind one of the most, tremendous television shows in history, Mystery Science Theater 3000. They are going to be bringing their brand of live riffing to different movies at Logan Theater this weekend. And they are in studio, the Mads. On a Download. It's so great to have you guys here.
Great to thank be you. Here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Chicago.
Talk about this. I mean, you guys tour this. I mean, this is something that you guys do live. I mean, the live riff. Talk about the experience of doing what essentially made you guys famous.
Well, yeah, it's like watching a Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode, except without robots, although we can be robotic sometimes.
Yes.
But it's basically, it's the experience of Mystery Science Theater, except with a live audience, which makes it that much more fun and that much better
It's like watching NASCAR at home or being at NASCAR.
Right.
We are right. like being at NASCAR.
And we, right. we crash a lot, believe me.
Yes. But, that's what people want to see.
Yes.
Is it at all challenging for you to do this in a live experience with a live audience behind you? I mean, I would assume they'd want to play along. Are they well-disciplined?
Oh, people are very well-behaved. Our fans yeah. are some of the more well-behaved people. We played Milwaukee last year. And the group coming in after us were Insane Clown Posse. And the contrast between their fans and our fans is quite spectacularly yes. different.
You guys don't share a lot of crossover appeal?
No, we don't have a lot of liquids flying through the air in our show.
We're like the Rational Clown Posse.
No, our fans are great. And it's fantastic to do live shows because we are on our toes. And
it's very we work from a script, but it gets very spontaneous, and you know, we just react to whatever is happening,
and then people are very polite, wouldn't you say?
They're very supportive, and they laugh a lot, which we love.
And Chicago has been one of the strongest markets.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
been great because we've done at North Bar a few times, and Jim, who produced those shows, he's producing these shows at the Logan Theater, and this will be our third time back, I think.
Yeah,
Chicago,
yeah. We share this Midwest sensibility that flows through. The Dakotas down through Minnesota, through Wisconsin to Illinois and Chicago. The cast was largely made up of, and then we kidnapped Frank.
Yeah, well, it was all Midwesterners. I was the token New Yorker, so.
But we convinced you.
When I first started the show, I started the second season. It was on the Comedy Channel, Comedy Central. They had a budget to build a new set, but we all were part of the building of the set. Everyone else on staff grew up in the Midwest. They had worked with power tools. They had worked with wood. They had worked with
They're in our cribs.
Right. The closest thing my dad had to a power tool in our Manhattan apartment was a martini mixer. So I was
you could make the drinks.
Yes. Yeah. So yes, exactly. So I was a bit out of my element.
A very important Midwest element, by the way, making the drinks.
That was the one part of the job I wasn't good at. But once the set was built and then we were able to actually just write comedy, then I was good.
Well, I have so many questions about the process and the scene at that time in the 90s in Minneapolis and getting this idea, Mystery Science Theater, off the ground.
Right.
As well as just the concept of refining and really getting into the idea of live riffing because that's something that everyone thinks they can do, but the minute it starts to flow, it's not that easy. Trace and Frank in studio, the Mads, the legendary comedians who were part of Mystery Science Theater 3000. They're going to be at the Logan Theater tomorrow night up in Milwaukee in Logan Square. Two shows, two different movies.
Yes.
So we'll continue the conversation. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The Mads are in studio, Trace Bilou and Frank Conniff, two great comedians and two of the brains behind one of the best television shows in history, Mystery Science Theater 3000. They are going to be on stage at the Logan Theater in Logan Square on Milwaukee Avenue tomorrow night. Two shows, two different live movies.
Completely different.
Talk about the movies. I mean, are these movies that you guys have crafted a routine to? I mean, is that the idea that you're like, over time, you're like, these are the best movies?
We find a movie, and then we write a bunch of riffs for it, and then we perform it live, and then our riffs evolve over the period of time of when we're doing it live. That's what I meant before about the spontaneous element. And you learn things about the jokes when you do it in front of an audience. Some jokes you think, oh, this is just going to kill, and it gets nothing. And then the one that you just, you know, didn't think much of, that gets a gigantic laugh, you know. So it's really educational for us.
Well, the movies, I mean, that you're going to do tomorrow at the Logan Theater, I mean, are they movies that you've done in the past where you're like, oh, these were the best ones we watched?
Or no,
are
these the kind of thing, you know? These are new discoveries. We're in the film noir genre tomorrow night. And there are two films that I had never seen before.
No, I never heard of either.
There's one that I can actually tell you the major star that is in this film, and you still won't know who it is. Chuck Connors, big star, branded. Mm-hmm.
Rifleman.
I came across this film as with a young Chuck Connors, and I had never seen this thing before. And we show it to audiences, and no one has ever seen this film.
And we're both film buffs. We're both pretty knowledgeable. Neither of us had ever heard of this film before.
This is a treat.
Found it somewhere.
This is like the Zika virus of films. It's a brand new virus.
Well, for you guys, I mean, you are film buffs. Uh-huh. How much? I mean, the obscure. There are some stores in Chicago and some places that really sort of work off of the obscure movie, the film that nobody's heard of. I mean, is that the kind of thing that you're sort of going through to find, or are you the kind of guys that just sort of are all encompassing, know everything about?
Well, I feel that we're pretty all encompassing. We're into the cult weird stuff as well as. We do a podcast, Trace and myself, called Movie Sign with the Mads,
Carolina Hidalgo,
where we talk about movies and we talk about all different kinds of movies. But I think people assume with us that we're into the weird cult things.
Right. I wonder why.
But when I'm just home, watching Turner Classic Movies, I want to watch Citizen Kane. I don't necessarily want to watch some obscure bad movie.
We're looking for good films, but it's always a treat when we find something that we haven't seen before or heard of, and it has all the qualities that we need for riffing in front of a live audience. There should be a plot.
Yeah.
It should be lit well. It should sound okay. It should have some actors in it.
Some.
Well, that's another surprising thing about this Chuck Connors movie we did, which we were really worried about because it's so dark and
it's slow. A bad print.
The first time we did it, it went over like gangbusters, and not just that people were laughing, but they were kind of into the plot too,
which
was really totally unexpected.
And people accept the because we're in that genre of bad movies and kind of obscure films, they'll forgive bad print or a little scratchy soundtrack. And if we can point that stuff out, and the audience is often ahead of us, and they see that stuff, and. If we can sometimes just get out of the way and let them enjoy the film, it makes our job easier.
There's something great. I mean, Mystery Science Theater and I even think locally we have Svengoolie.
Svengoolie. He's a good friend.
Yeah, I mean, there's this
I hope you're feeling better.
There's a tapping into this obscure sort of film world that we just sort of really as society, as humans, really, really enjoy, like watching the attempt at this art.
It's comforting.
Yeah, we do a lot of like Alamo Draft Houses around the country, and we've noticed there's just a film cult. There's a whole culture built around these films that have no culture. There's a whole culture around obscure sci-fi horror, Japanese horror movies or whatever. Like there's a certain audience that they love discovering films, kind of like we do.
Well, they feel sorry for them. It's sort of like a pet that has been neglected or that one pet that has a stutter, as Woody Allen used to talk about. And
there's a whole, every weekend there's a big blockbuster movie that opens up that gets a lot of attention. But then there's the whole history of film out there that's just out there to be watched. And I think there's a lot of people who find a lot of value in that and don't necessarily aren't as interested in the mainstream of what's happening. They want to go dig deep and find what's out, treasures.
For whether you guys are live riffing at the Logan Theater or back in the day with Mystery Science Theater 3000, I mean, how important was it to have the right movie? I mean, you guys can make jokes on top of it,
really,
but how
important
was the movie?
I thought it was extremely important that we find all the correct elements to make a good riffable movie. And then Frank found Manos, the Hands of Fate, and my theory was completely out the window.
And that was, Yeah, that was, some movies are just special. What can I tell you?
It's special, Manos, in that way.
In that weird way. And Manos, The Hands of Fate is one of them that just affects people in a way that's probably not healthy.
Well, there's that theory of there's perfection in imperfection.
Yes.
And that great art needs something like a crooked smile or a little bit of something off. And Manos has all of that in spades.
Yes.
Well, Frank and Trace, the Mads will be at the Logan Theater tomorrow night for two shows, the Logan Theater in Logan Square on Milwaukee Avenue. They will be doing two different movies in the film noir.
Yeah, the film noir genre, plus a couple of short films.
Okay.
Educational,
you got to go out and see it. All right, so we'll take a quick break. If you guys can stick around, we'll talk some more here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. In studio with me right now, the Mads, Trace Belew, and Frank Conniff, two comedians who were behind the one of the best television shows of all times, Mystery Science Theater 3000. They are on stage at the Logan Theater tomorrow night for two shows, two different movies, at the Logan Theater in Logan Square. You can find it. It's in Milwaukee Avenue. Just Google Logan Theater. Find it. I know it's like 2700 block or something like that.
Something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. You know, talking to you guys about not just about the obscure films, but just about the process of picking these apart and making fun of these. I mean, you guys and the crew at Mystery Science Theater and Joel, you guys really grabbed something. You grabbed something that's been done for a while. We were talking about Spengouli and Elvira and others that have done the sort of presenting the film. But you guys took it a step further by being in it, having the plot around it. I mean, were you surprised at just how much you guys sort of got lightning in a bottle with this concept?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it started out, we were not going to be riffing on films. We were just going to, like, watch these movies and maybe throw in an odd fact here and there. But when we were first doing it, Joel and Josh Weinstein, J. Elvis Weinstein, and I... We were all stand-up comics, and we were desperate to fill dead air with something. And so we started quipping with each other and quipping back and forth and trying to make each other laugh.
Like everybody? I mean, that it really is when you watch a movie like this on the couch.
Yeah, we were doing everyone does this at home.
Yeah.
And we just had an opportunity where we could apply that to something that was being recorded. And so it was never thought out, like, we're going to riff and be popular cultural mavens, and it just happened. And I think that's what the audience responds to, is like something we were doing at home, and now they're doing it, and now we're watching this show with people we like, and it's very warm and comforting.
There was something great about the camaraderie of it, the connection we had with you guys.
Yeah.
Talk about the process behind the scenes when you guys were getting ready. I mean, you're working in ensemble. There's this idea of all watching a movie together.
When we were doing Mystery Science Theater 3000, we were all together in one place in Eden Prairie, Minnesota.
Not to brag.
And just thought I'd drop that in there. And we were all in one room writing together, which is a really fun way to do it.
Yes.
But now Trace and I Trace lives in Minneapolis. I live in New York City. And so we write separately. And then when we go on the road, we get together and we go over what we've written.
We're like the scientists at Los Alamos. We can't join our two parts of the bomb together until we get in the same area.
And there's a third bomb if you count the movie.
Yes.
But so it's a different process. It's not as fun to just sit, which we both do. We watch the movie alone with our computer, write in riffs as we're watching the movie. That's not quite as fun as when you're sitting with your friends.
Right.
Like at Mystery Science Theater, we would yell out jokes, and then there would be someone who would type. We'd stop the film. Someone would type it down. And we always had the people who type the riffs in were always people who worked with us at Best Brains who didn't really care that much for what we were doing.
They didn't like the show.
There was one girl who's a wonderful person, Heidi, and she'd be sitting behind me. I'd yell out some riff, and then she'd like hit me on the head with a newspaper and like a dog, and she'd go, "I like Kenny Rogers." You know, she didn't like we were making fun of her favorite pop pop icons. So, right. But it was such a fun process. And in this version of it, when the fun starts, really starts when we get in front of an audience. And
absolutely.
Then that's even more fun than even writing the film with other people.
The audience is the third collaborator,
yeah.
or fourth, if you count the film. We come together and we make the Beatles of riffing. Oh, what a horrible thing to say. I didn't say that.
That's the pull quote.
Oh, geez.
Pull that out.
But it takes the audience, the film, us.
And people don't know that Yoko broke up Mystery Science Theater. No, I'm kidding. Just making that up.
Noko.
Are you guys surprised? What's the emotion when you think to... I mean, you guys are cult status. I mean, you go to Comic-Cons. Mm-hmm. I mean, people will show up. I mean, what's your thought on becoming cult status?
We're
from
cult
the show?
Status in that room, but the moment we leave the theater, and Josh talks about this all the time, we're famous in the room, but then we hit the street and no one knows who we are.
Right.
Which is great.
It's actually
kind of the best of both worlds.
Cult fame is the only kind of fame that I've experienced, such as it is. And it has to be the best kind of fame, because you go to one specific place, you're treated like an idol,
yeah.
and then you leave, and then you can go have a normal life, you know. And it, I think that kind of is like the best of both worlds.
You know what I find so interesting is that Mystery Science Theater really was ahead of its time, and also a part of, like we talked about some of the ones before that the predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you've seen so much interaction with audiences because of social media. You see what shows, game shows, Comedy Central at Midnight is one that, you know, there's so much, Jimmy Fallon. And it almost feels like it was tailor-made, like Twitter was tailor-made for a Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah.
Talk about the audience and the generations that follow you guys and are aware of what you guys have done.
Well, you think it would be all old people like us, but we continually meet families where either the kid got the parents into it or the parents raised the children on the show. It's timeless. If it's funny, it doesn't matter what your age is. And if you're a cool kid and a nerdy kid, like I think we were, you find these comedic elements that you love, like Monty Python or you know, hopefully our show.
It's amazing how that it's still popular. It literally is more popular now than when we were doing it. When we were never recognized anywhere, because that was like back when like Comedy Central wasn't on in every cable system.
I guess so.
And it's literally everyone from the show can tell you it's a much bigger thing now than it ever was when we were doing it. And you know, people will say to me, well, you do these Comic Cons and these sci-fi conventions. I bet you meet a lot of weirdos there. And then I'm like, no, I actually meet people that I consider like incredibly normal. We meet these families that come, the dad and the mom and the kids. They're all into the show.
Yeah.
They're all a family out doing something together, sharing something that they all love. It's like my ideal. I'm like, why can't I be like you? I'm the weirdo. I come from a dysfunctional
family.
No,
but I mean, there's something to be said about, I mean, I have that relationship with my dad. I mean, I was a teenager, I was probably 20, 21 when Mystery Science, but there's something where it's like when Mystery Science was on, it was like, this was something we both related to, and he enjoyed the sort of schlock of it, and I enjoyed how funny you guys were. It was a great mix.
And we were kind of, in terms of our pop culture references, we did stuff from every era of popular culture, whether it was the 20s or the 30s or ancient Greece, 1990s references. We did, you know, we did more Adlai Stevenson references than we did Bill Clinton references. So, you know,
let me ask you both. I mean, as you guys continue to tour and do the live riff off the movie, The Mads are going to be at the Logan Theater tomorrow night. You know, I think about that premise, the premise of essentially, you know, you guys created the almost great sort of complicated premise to get you guys into space and it was punishment to watch these films. But I think about it. I'm like, why hasn't that been replicated? Why haven't we seen a copycat generation of shows that do the live riffing like you guys did with Mystery Science Theater on TV, in pop culture? I mean, with the improvisation and comics, you'd see more of that.
Well, there's a lot of it, not necessarily on television. There's a lot of that going on with comedians and improv groups. A lot, you know, New York where I live, there's several different people who have nights where just comedians go and riff movies. Or I did a show once where they riff video games, you know.
Yeah,
so
right.
There's a lot of that stuff going on.
Like on stages,
yeah,
or
it's
even
not
on,
happening.
On YouTube, things like that.
It's not happening on the TV level as much, just because I think TV people are always the last to catch up with anything.
Well, and it was always the underdog. It was always, and I don't think it should be more mainstream. I think it should be more cultish and more more like Mad Magazine, you know, where it's. It has to bite a little bit, and you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think it. Some of that cool stuff just exists outside the mainstream,
yeah, right.
And like I still talk to people who don't have any idea what Monty Python is, and I'm astounded.
Yeah.
Or Laurel and Hardy, and I go, "Don't you have a sense of humor?" Mm-hmm. And it's just it just doesn't. Go into their stream of consciousness.
Well, maybe we'll wrap here, but I mean, the question I would ask you guys, I mean, is as you mentioned those Monty Python and Laurel and Hardy, and a lot of comics of your generation and even mm-hmm. my generation will say those are our inspirations. Those are people mm-hmm. that we look up to. For you guys, I mean, what is it? How does it feel to be someone's Monty Python? I mean, there's a lot of comedians right now who are like, will say Mystery Science Theater is what I grew up on. This is what I knew. This is why I got into this.
That's a great feeling. I have heard that from people, and I can't believe it when they. I've heard, you know, like for me, my two big shows coming up that influenced me like crazy were SCTV and Monty Python.
Yes.
And I've heard people compare us to that, and it's just. The greatest compliment. And I've had, you know, I still do stand-up comedy and I do stand-up in New York City a lot. I had one young comic come up to me and say, your show is the reason I got into comedy. And it just blows me away when I hear that, you know.
Yeah. I was at a dinner with John Cleese from Monty Python, and one of the kids at the table leaned across John and said, Mystery Science Theater changed my life. And I said, no, you're wrong.
You're wrong.
You are wrong. This man changed your life. And I will not accept anything other than that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the Mads are going to be at the Logan Theater tomorrow night for two shows, riffing off of two movies, also some shorts, things in the middle. Frank Conniff, Trace Belew, I mean, really known as the Mads, but also two of the comedians that were involved with Mystery Science Theater 3000, the iconic show that ran on Comedy Central and Sci-Fi Network for years. Great to meet you guys.
Thank you so much.
And
we'll be available to sign box sets. If you bring stuff, we'll take pictures. That's all for free.
We go tomorrow night at the Logan Theater. Thanks, guys.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
So fun, huh? What a great show tonight. Such great performers in studio that have really made an impact. Whether it be local with the Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind cast or with Mystery Science Theater 3000. Sebastian Bach from Skid Row, who didn't show up. And you know what? I want to say, you know, I love the relationship we have. The Download Nation, for me to actually be in a position where I can read from Sebastian Bach's book. You know, there was a time, I think, and I'll be honest, like there was a time early on here, but also my other jobs where, you know, if we got the word an hour before that Sebastian Bach was not coming through, Pete and I, we would scramble. We'd be like, well, what are we going to talk about? What are we going to do? We'd find some. But we went with it where we just wanted to talk about Sebastian Bach and read some from his book, did some impromptu poetry over Skid Row music. And it worked out. I got some great text that people said they liked it. We may have come up with a new segment reading, you know, bad rock memoirs. Bad Rock Memoir Theater 3000. But because of that, I want to do something nice for you at home, right? This is something that we have, and we found out about this, and we're like, okay, we can do this. We can. Sarah said we could give away these tickets as well. I got a pair of tickets to James Taylor and his all-star band with special guest Bonnie Raitt, July 17th at Wrigley Field. Tickets are on sale now at cubs.com/James Taylor. This is something that they were giving away on Rose Show all day. I think they gave away a little bit on Cochrane. Let's go. I got one pair. Let's do 18th caller for 18th in life. Skid Row. So, Sebastian, you guys can thank Sebastian Bach for these tickets. 312-981-7200. The 18th caller is going to get a pair of tickets to see James Taylor and his all-star band, special guest Bonnie Raitt. Let's give them something to talk about. How about love? Love. Love. Just like Sebastian Bach, right?
Does James Taylor have a memoir?
We could just read. I'm sure he does. I'm sure Bonnie Raitt does.
Yeah.
I feel like that. Yeah, I feel like it's a never-ending fountain of material for us, since every rock and roller now has an autobiography or memoir to talk about how they partied with John Bon Jovi. It's always the same. And then it's me and John Bon Jovi. It's me and I feel like Motley Crue is probably the epicenter. You know, and I think I read every single rock and roll memoir, and I judge it against Motley Crue's The Dirt.
Mm-hmm.
If you have not read, have you read that book? That book is tremendous. I can't tell you. I mean, at some point in our download history, we will try to get one of the guys from Crue. We tried to get Nikki Six on when he was coming through town and didn't even respond to us.
Yeah.
Or the writer. The writer of that book was a famed writer, like the ghostwriter, the guy who put it together. Because that book was so cool. And you know what? If you've read it, you know what I'm talking about. They essentially told the same stories from different points of view. Each member of the band wrote the book. So there'd be one, like, remember the pool party at Vince Neil's place? Vince would be like, I had a pool party. Tommy would be like, hey, Vince had this pool party. Nikki Six, I met this girl at Vince's pool party. Like, it's
it,
like
it was
that.
It was all corroborated.
And then they'd also disagree with each other. That was the fun of it. They'd be like, you know, Vince always tells the story this way, but it didn't happen this way. It happened this way. Or they'd talk about, I was really mad at Vince that day. He stole my lady. That kind of stuff. So it's actually tremendous, tremendous book. It was one of those that I think I've read twice. And I always look at it and I'm like, so when Sebastian Bach's memoir comes across, I'm like, grab sold. I want to know all about Farm Aid or whatever they played in the weird, you know, desert for 150,000 people. And there's some of that, you know. There's also like just, and I hate to say it, but like he says, you know, he doesn't want to be a bad boy, but like there's a moment he tells a story where he's at the Rainbow Club in LA where he's sitting with David Lee Roth and Axl Rose. And it was so crowded, and someone called his name, and he couldn't get out of the booth. So he just climbed and walked from table to table. But the place had dinner, so he was stepping on people's dinner.
Hmm.
And the Rainbow Club kicked him out for life. Like, they're like, you're out. And I'm like, what kind of sort of, you know, privileged rock star is like, you know, hey, I don't care. I'm going to walk on your food. Like, I mean, there's one thing to like put needles in your arm or snort cocaine or whatever, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But when you start stepping on people's food,
draw the line somewhere.
You are no longer the protag in this story. You are the anti-hero. That was my takeaway. And I think Bon Jovi and Bon Jovi's dad felt the same way. Anyway. All right, we'll take a quick break. Greg Flamm is coming up. We're going to do the swap meet. All right, it's the download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it is Thursday night, 10 o'clock, and that means it's time for the swap meet. Greg Flamm is in studio. It has been a long time. I feel like we have not had a good Thursday night on the download in, 6 weeks. But the swap meet is back, and it's even got its own brand new theme song.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books. Or silverware, as long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for swap meet with Justin Kaufman.
Nice.
Jason Skaggs, Greg Flamm in studio. He's at DuPage Picker on Twitter and Facebook. This is a segment where we have you call in and we evaluate your Chicago memorabilia, your Chicago junk. Hey, it's not junk, it's Chicago history. 312-981-7200 is the number. We really need you to call in and give us, I mean, it's been so long. I feel like in the last 6 weeks, there have been plenty of times where you've been in your garage going, you know, I got to call Greg on this one.
Yep.
This is the one I got. How you been, buddy?
I'm awesome. It's great to be back.
Yeah,
thanks.
It is great. We're
gonna... And good job on the intro music. That's awesome.
Is it it's first time in your life you've had a theme song?
Right. Yeah. I don't know what to do. I have so much pressure now, you know.
Really, someone, we'll get has to, someone has to pay for that theme song, Greg.
Right. Well,
that's the thing.
I'll try to pick something nice out of the state so far.
Well, as 312-981-7200, that's the phone number. If you want to call in and get Greg's opinion, advice, thoughts on a piece of memorabilia, history, junk, it could be sports, it could be politics, it can be stuff you picked up from Marshall Field back in the day, and as I always joke, could be that one piece of... That poster you got when the Pope came to town.
Right.
I feel like that we get one of those a night,
right,
which is good.
The scarf was the best. The Pope's scarf was the best.
All right. So, Greg, what do you got? You always bring in goodies for us. Let's talk about
things.
What you got here.
Okay. Obviously, 1980, John Lennon, and I brought in some of that.
That's today.
Yeah. Kind of.
I did not know that. I didn't hear any of that.
Yeah, 36 years ago. So I brought in a couple John Lennon things. I brought in kind of a rare game called Chop Suey by Ideal. And it's not very PC. I just love it.
It's a game called Chop Suey?
Yeah.
Look at this thing.
Yeah, it's you know, those.
Oh, my.
And
let's say you don't have to be Chinese to play Chop Suey game.
Right, and it looked like it came out in 1967.
So it's a bunch of bowls and chopsticks.
Right, and you got to use chopsticks to move stuff from one bowl, I guess, to the other. Yeah. And, you know,
classic.
Kind of the skill.
I guess classic.
Right. Yeah. Obviously, I never heard of it, so it couldn't have been too much of a classic. I think I got it for $2. It's worth it's worth about $40, $45.
Really?
Even in that condition,
are looking for Chop Suey.
Well, what it is the company Ideal that makes it. They made a whole line of toys, and people just collect the whole line.
Okay.
And then I brought in the Nintendo Game & Watch, the Mario Brothers one.
Okay, what is that?
And so basically it's a compact that kind of opens. It's got two sides with LCD screens on each side. And it's Mario Brothers in its primitive form. And it also had all of them have a little clock up in the far right corner. So hence Game & Watch.
I've never seen that before.
And these
in my
are collectible.
Life. What is
this
that?
One's not in the best shape. The battery
cover.
It
almost looks like a cigarette case.
Yeah, it's like a compact, almost like a mirror thing for like makeup.
Yeah,
but
and then you open it up and it's a really kind of primitive.
Yeah, and I picked it for $1 and they're worth about $60. So it wasn't a bad find. And
I mean, how often? I mean, I've asked you this before, but it's been 6 weeks and we're past the summer in the garage sales.
Yeah, it's a state
sale
season.
How often are you coming across stuff that you know in your head is worth $60 and it's sitting there for $1?
I knew the Game & Watch were collectible. And what was odd is it was not out. So one of the things, advice I would give is if you walk up on a garage sale, ask what you collect. I collect posters. So I always, hey, do you have any posters in the back? Because sometimes they don't think to put the stuff out at a garage sale, especially. Mm. So I just kind of asked them, hey, this is what I collect, records, posters, whatever. And they're like, hey, wait a minute. So she went back and got this like shoebox full of these like video games. Most of them were just like Solitaire or Scrabble, whatever. And this was in the box. And I jumped at it, of course. And, I asked what she wanted for it. She said $1. And I jumped at it, So, and it even had the instruction manual, which is kind of hard to find with them now.
Well, the number to call to talk to Greg about your Chicago memorabilia is 312-981-7200. You can text or get on the line. Two things. One, this being the 36th anniversary of John Lennon's death, Sebastian Bach, when he found out the news, he cried. He was a kid.
Oh, okay.
So I'm just letting you know. I mean, I read this book. Also, you said you collect posters. This was the inset. Look at that thing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right?
That is awesome.
How much is that worth? on the market. If you found this original poster with the gold pants, the hip huggers, like that kind of thing that you would get at like Spencer's Gift, how much are you getting for one of these?
Oh, that size, I don't know. I'm speechless. You got me. You stumped me on that one, Justin.
See, this is the kind of thing right here.
Yeah, that
this
is the thing.
This is the kind of thing that just defines a person.
Yeah.
We'll take a picture and maybe I'll put it on Instagram.
If it was the whole band, I would buy it. Like,
you
if
would?
I saw it for like $1 at a garage sale, I'd buy it if it was the whole band. Because that 80s rock stuff, is collectible and it will sell.
All right, there you go. Greg Flamm in studio at DuPage Picker on Twitter and Facebook. 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We will come back and we will start talking about your Chicago memorabilia. It's a swap meet. It's Thursday night, 720 WGN.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
With Greg Flamm. You're the star.
No, it's awesome.
At DuPage Picker, Greg Flamm in studio. It is time for the swap meets. 312-981-7200. Give us a ring. If you got something special, something Chicago, some memorabilia. Maybe you got an old Daily t-shirt. You know? Maybe you got a sewer grate.
Right. What was it? Ashtrays and
matchbook
cover.
Maybe you found a ledger. It's got a bunch of numbers in it.
Right.
Greg will let you know if it's worth anything. Right. That's my favorite part about swap meets. People call in with things from the old political days.
Yep.
I got a fedora that was once worn. I got an Indiana Jones fedora that Mayor Richard M. Daley used to wear. Remember when he used to wear almost the Indiana Jones hat?
Yep.
And the trench coat? All right, let's go to Katie. Katie, you are on the swap meet. What do you got?
Well, I have a 79 Chicago Fest poster.
Ooh.
Oh, those are always nice. Is it, sorry, go ahead.
It's in excellent condition because we had it framed years ago.
I was going to ask, is it the larger one or kind of the 11 by 17 one?
It's larger than 11 by 17.
Yeah, I've seen those for about $200, $250.
Wow.
So, yeah.
A poster?
Yeah, if it's in great condition.
Katie, how much did you pay for that poster when you got it?
I think I actually got it free.
Right.
It was when Chicago Fest was still at Navy Pier.
Yeah, wow. I've seen them at flea markets for about $200 at flea markets.
$200 bucks.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, thank you very much.
No
Katie,
problem.
This is
good,
your lucky
good
night.
Job.
Way to go. Way to go framing that thing. That's the thing that
frame it for sure.
Don't roll it up. Don't put a rubber band on that.
Right. No rubber bands.
Don't do it my style and just fold it in half.
Right.
Maybe fold it in eighths.
Oh man. I have poster stories if you want.
Yeah, you're a poster collector.
I love posters. Because obviously there's part of it that's art, and then the other is pop culture. And a couple stories I had. I had the Archie Bunker full door size poster.
Really?
And it was torn up the middle almost three quarters of the way, and I think it still sold for like $100. I had a Bruce Springsteen one from the Playboy magazine. It was a commemorative with that back in the 70s. And someone, it smelled like perfume. Someone, and it had the stain of perfume like down the middle of it. Still got like $250 for that.
Come
thing.
On.
I am not joking.
How much would a Alyssa Milano in a New Jersey Devils hockey jersey and ripped jeans, what's that going for?
I'd have to look that up. I at this point, I say 15.
That's the one I had.
Yeah.
And then I remember I ruined it. I ripped it. By, I don't know what I was thinking. I mean, I think I know what I was thinking being a 13-year-old kid.
Oh, yeah.
But I was like, you know, it'd be cool if I had Alyssa Milano on the ceiling.
Right.
You know, so when I laid down, I could see Alyssa Milano in the hockey jersey, not really knowing essentially what that meant. And taping it up to the ceiling, I ruined it.
Oh, okay.
Like I couldn't get it to stay right, and I like crinkled it and broke a side. It was a whole bit.
I'm a little bit older, so my poster growing up was the Farrah Fawcett one.
Right,
that was
right.
me. So, and I had a cool uncle who was the kind of had the Playboy collection going, and he surprised me and got me the poster because I saw it at his house, and I'm like, I gotta have that, you know. But yeah.
All right, 630 says we have a John Entwistle Who by Numbers seriograph. What's a seriograph? Seriograph? S-E-R-I-O graph?
It's probably the artwork, I guess, or original artwork, or numbered. You know,
It said it's numbered out of 300 made.
Okay. Yeah, that, obviously, the Entwistle Who stuff is pretty big. I have to look that up. I can maybe let us know after the break, but it's definitely collectible, and he's got a good find there.
And the question is, again, like, that has to be in good condition to get the money you're talking
about.
Yeah,
and I'm sure he's got it framed. I don't think he's got it laying around, or whoever it was had it. But, yeah, that's...
if it's numbered, it's always worth it.
What does that mean? What's numbered?
Like it's one of 300 or...
So it has like a little number, like 17
yeah,
on it?
Yeah, we'll see on the bottom corner usually like 17 of 30 or 17 of 300. And obviously for collectors, they want the lower the number, the better. They want one of 300 or one of 50.
What's a generic poster of a Lamborghini going for these days? I feel like I had one of those too.
Again, I
no,
said
those
bucks,
aren't working.
$10, I said.
That or maybe, and I remember like having the Alyssa Milano, the Lamborghini, and then like couldn't let go of childhood. So I'm like, maybe one Garfield.
Garfield,
you know,
right.
Let's get a Garfield right. Odie right. Poster in as well. Realize yep. quickly, not cool.
Right.
All right.
Yeah. No, posters are cool though. They're definitely.
We can do posters all night.
Right.
All right, Kathy, what do you got? What do you want to brag about on the swap meet here?
Well, I had the one thing, and then when you started talking about number of prints, I had two things.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
The first one is R.J. Grunt's Peter Max poster.
Okay.
From like around 1976 when I bought it.
Is that are we talking about the restaurant?
R.J. Grunt's.
R.J. Grunt's one.
Yeah, restaurant, right?
The restaurant, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was a print from the restaurant.
And how big is that, would you estimate?
It's really big. It's like...
That's a good estimation.
Yeah, I mean, that would probably be more than Justin's Alyssa Milano poster, I'd say.
No, that's bogus.
I'm going to say, I mean, offhand, I'd say 50 to 100 start an auction there, and I'm going to look it up while we're talking here and see if I can get it.
All right, Kathy, what's the other thing you got?
The other thing is that I think this is a local artist named James Swan.
Okay.
And I have two prints. They're etchings.
Where'd you get them?
As gifts, but he had a gallery here at 400 Webster.
All right. Well, I mean, if you have and
but I don't.
I don't know. I would. I'll take this one if you don't mind, Greg.
No, go for it.
I would just assume because it's an artist and they're prints and they're professional art, and he's got a gallery. It did have a gallery down on, you know, as you said, on what did you say, Webster, whatever it was. Yeah. I would assume that they're worth something in the sense that they're worth whatever that artist is worth at this point, right?
Yeah,
right.
I'll have to Google them and find out.
Yeah, I don't know.
Was the other?
Have two of them.
Sorry, was the other poster? Did it have like a blue background? The RJ Grant. Yeah, there's two of them on eBay right now for $1,250.
$1,200?
$1,250. That's what they're asking. That's not sold.
Oh, really? So it's
going
to be like
I couldn't find a sold one. Yeah,
$1,250?
Yeah, that's what they're asking. But, you know, you can ask $1 million for a potato chip, you know, until it's actually sold, you know. And I couldn't find any sold.
It's got an orange person with yellow in the middle, and the R.J. Grunt is in orange, and it says Peter Max on it.
Right, and then the background's blue,
$1,250.
And there's a face in
it. I don't know what to tell you there. I definitely, you know, you could start at $499 auction and see if it gets up to $1,000.
If you get $1,250, you should throw a party and
invite everyone.
Invite everyone you know.
Right.
Yeah, because I was leaving Chicago to go to San Francisco to live for a while, and I wanted something to put up when I got there.
Oh,
I bought it.
That's great.
I was at the restaurant one night just on a whim.
That's great. Well, all right. Congrats, Kathy. I hope that works
thank
out
you.
For you. Good luck.
Yeah, right. I think it did.
There you
very
go.
Very nice.
Thank you.
I'm more interested in this $1 million potato chip. We'll talk about that right. in the break here. It's
Johnny Carson episode.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a swap meet, 312-981-7200, as you just heard, Kathy. Just want to find out about that R.J. Grunt's print.
There you go.
Greg
that was
told
a good
her
one.
It's right now being auctioned on eBay for $1,200, $1,250.
Two of them, yep.
All right, so we'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. 312-981-7200. It's a swap meet.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure. Like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose. Today, you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books. Or silverware, as long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
Yeah, Jason Skaggs. Man, look at that. We got
very
a theme
nice.
Song.
I know.
Greg Flam in studio at DuPage Picker on Twitter and Facebook. It's Swap Meet where we evaluate Chicago memorabilia. What do you got that you want to brag about? 312-981-7200. We got a lot of people on the line. Also some texts. You know, just from the last break, The person had the
it was like a number
seriograph, numbered seriograph. They said they also it's from the 25th anniversary of the Quadrophenia tour.
Okay, the Who by Numbers went for about $35. Unless it's signed, it will be worth more. If the Quadrophenia, that I don't know. I have to further look up that.
Okay, I'm just a little disappointed you don't know more about Quadrophenia tour.
I'm a big Who fan, but.
All right, let's go to Lucy. Lucy, what do you want to brag about, Lucy?
Hi, Lucy.
Hi. Thanks, guys. I have a Bruce Springsteen flag from the Tunnel of Love tour when he was in Berlin, and the backdrop of the stage was the American flag with his image impressed on it.
Wow.
And there were multiples of those on the backdrop of the stage. I have that. I have a crew jacket from the Tunnel of Love.
Wow. How'd you get that?
And my sister was and her husband were stagehands.
Okay.
My sister is a costumer, and then my brother-in-law is a lighting expert.
That's awesome.
That is. How big would you say the flags were? Are they banners or flags? How big are those?
The flag is like a nylon or a silk material, and it's probably 2.5 by 4 or maybe 3 by 5.
Okay.
And then the poster is a traditional size, publicity poster for the concert. And then the jacket is a jacket.
Can I ask you a question, as we get real deep on the issue, what this is worth. What were the songs on the Tunnel of Love tour?
This came
what are
up
we talking
before.
About? Yeah,
Tunnel of Love was one. Brilliant Disguise was the other hit, I think.
There were... Yeah. See, you're talking about one of the tours I'm not interested in.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm drawing a blank.
Let's get back to Skid Row.
I came from the Tony Orlando show at the riverboat show in Elgin. So
was Tony Orlando doing Quando Quando Quando? Did he do that song?
No, actually, it was a very nice Christmas. A lot of Christmas music.
All right.
He knows he's been doing it. He knows his game.
So the Springsteen stuff you have is obviously not something that was mass produced or mass sold. It was even the jackets aren't really mass sold. I mean, back then.
No, this is all for the crew only.
Sure,
and a video. He makes a video every time he does a tour and gives it only to the staff.
Right. Mm-hmm. So are you looking to just get a value or do you really want to sell it?
No, I don't want to sell it. Yeah. No, I'm not
on it. I would say... I the one thing I love about it is it's an American flag with his face on it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, come on.
I think he's a little bit more humble these days.
Right?
Yeah, born in. Hey, Germany, check me out. I'm USA.
Right, I'm
that's
on the flag.
It, right?
Right.
That's great.
That is awesome.
Lucy, that's awesome. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Lucy.
I like that.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank
bye.
You.
Although it'd be better if Hungry Heart was on that tour. Would that everybody's got a hungry heart. That wouldn't have been Tunnel of Love.
No, it was earlier.
You know what? Forget this. Let's go to Rick. Rick, what do you got, Rick?
Hi, Rick.
Hey, I got a 1942 Briggs & Stratton safety cycle.
Oh.
Okay.
What is a safety cycle?
It's an old stretched out bicycle.
Okay.
And on the bottom is a the clutch and the brake both. And it's got like an old lawnmower throttle.
Okay.
On it.
All right. So it's actually like motorized?
Yeah, it is motorized.
Huh.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's like a okay. So it's,
I'm thinking it came from a catalog.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not really seeing that here.
Yeah. And
bicycles aren't. No,
really I've had
my thing.
Hard time trying to find it.
Where do you get it? Where did you get it?
Right.
Got it from an old neighbor.
Huh. Okay.
He had it in his garage, and I thought he had something else, and he said he'd sell it to me, and I picked it up.
How much did you get it for?
$50.
Yeah, all right. I'm sure it's worth more than that. Obviously, bicycles are, especially older bicycles.
Yeah.
Does it work?
Yes, it does.
All right.
I got the original leather seat and the title and everything else for it, too.
Yeah, I see parts for it online. I just don't see the whole bike, so I don't know if I could help you there.
Hmm. Maybe Greg and I got to come by.
Well, I've never found parts for it.
Oh, that's good.
Okay.
Maybe Greg and I got to come by and take a spin, see what this thing's worth. It.
Right.
Right?
Mark that for summer.
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Thanks, Rick.
Right,
sorry
thanks,
we couldn't help on that. I don't know anything about that one. Let's go to Rick. Rick, you got a poster, and poster seems to be the theme of the night.
Yeah, poster night.
What do you got? What do you want to brag about?
Okay, I got two things. Number one's a Jane Burns Circus in Town poster when she was mayor.
Okay.
Circus in Town.
Yep.
What does that mean? Like, is it an anti-Jane Byrne? Like, oh, the circus is here. Was she like...
No, it was showing Jane Byrne with Jane Byrne Circus. I think they had it on Michigan Avenue at the time.
Oh, she, like, it was like sponsored circus?
Yeah.
Like a Jane Byrne Circus, like a Mayor Daley Airport?
Right.
Yeah.
Daley and the guys took over and they started naming, right. like, institutions. Jane Byrne got a circus? Okay, got it.
Yeah. I'm not saying it, but I...
That's interesting.
You know, I'd say start it at $50 and it might go up from there.
What else you got? You said you had
what
two
What was
things,
the
Rick?
Other poster?
I got two Anton Cermak's books when he was mayor that's with his signature in them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rick, you're speaking my language now.
I'll let you take that one.
I like that. So it's what like it's something he wrote.
No, no, no. There's something when he was in the government, some government publications like, or like, something.
Oh, and he just was like. Yeah. So, like I said earlier, if you got any ledgers from old politicians,
right.
this is it.
Right.
Wow, that's interesting. I don't know what I mean. That might be something where you should check the Historical Society, because I wonder if Anton Cermak's a big enough name. He is, obviously, and if there's something in there that like talks about the time when he was mayor and he's actually got a signature on it. I wonder if that they might be interested in something like that.
Yeah, I think that I heard that our present mayor. Uses Cermak's desk.
Oh, there you go. Maybe nice. He needs the governmental books as well. All right. Well,
thank you.
All right. Thanks, Rick. That's good.
There's some Cermak books for about $25 online.
All right.
FYI.
Let's keep going. Let's do James. James, what do you got, James?
Hey, yeah, James. Hi. I got six typewriters.
Wow. Okay.
Why do you have six typewriters?
I was bored.
All right.
I love it.
Are they what, all?
Yeah, tell us about the typewriters.
They're not electric, right?
No, no, they're not like IBM Selectrics. They're right. they're pretty mechanical. Typically between the era of 1952 and 1958, from a company called Groma, based out of Communist Berlin.
Wow.
Oh, geez.
Yep.
Wow.
So there's Groma Gromina, and then I also have a Groma Calibri.
Okay, I'm seeing one for about $48, and obviously
$48. Where's that?
Yeah, on eBay. It's 1958, and it's actually being sold from Germany. It is a bluish color.
How much did you want for them?
$48 sounds pretty good.
Yeah, and I'm sure because of the weight of it, the shipping's probably like $35 or something. But there's only one.
That's where they get you.
Yeah, that's where they do get you. But there is one on eBay, so get them up there and then say that one's, you know what? Put some negative comments on that one and be like, yeah, I don't like the paint job on that.
Or if it's
and
undervalued. You,
yeah,
if it's undervalued, buy it.
Yeah, then. You get a little 55. Or buy it undervalued and get another one to your collection.
Right.
James, you got a lot of options here.
There you go. Options
all right, thanks,
good.
Buddy. Thanks, yeah. James.
Thank you.
All right, let's go. Let's take a quick break, and I'm going to come back. I got Susan. I still got Rob. I got Vic. I got some people we want to get talk about what they have, what they want to brag about, Chicago memorabilia here on the Swap Meet. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam's in studio. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, Facebook and Twitter. It's a Swap Meet every Thursday night here on The Download when we have a show, of course. Greg will be back next Thursday as well. 312-981-7200. All right, the lines are jacked up here, so let's do some rapid fire, right? Let's try to go through this and see if we can see if we can help some people. Susan, let's go with you first. Susan, what do you want to brag about, Susan?
Well, my daddy served in Korea from 60 to 63, and he passed away in 2002. And when he came home from Korea, he brought some artifacts back.
Sure.
And I'm not going to sell them. Trump doesn't have enough money to give me.
Okay.
My daddy is my hero.
Of course.
That's great.
But I've got some authentic Korean dolls.
Okay.
And two picture frames. I think it's rice paper. I'm like 90% positive it's rice paper, and it's painted.
Okay.
And it's got pictures. They're black frames with like silver birds at the top and then kind of flowing down on the side is like the tail going down. And in one picture, it's a picture of two children, one in a red dress, in a red dress with like white sleeves that comes up to like the armpits, and then it's like white top, and then a rainbow colored on a little boy. And then in the other picture, it's a picture of a mother and daughter. Looks like they're walking next to a stream. Mm-hmm. And in the background, it's got authentic, like, it's mountain range. With,
right. Looking,
houses.
Sorry.
Yeah. But it's...
The rice paper paintings that go from anywhere from about $50 to, like, $500.
Whoa.
You know, you just have to try to find yours if it was... Obviously, right. It's probably one of a kind anyway. So
but in the genre of rice paper paintings, you can go anywhere from $50 to $500.
Yep. There's
yeah.
that.
Yeah. And then the doll. And then I got four dolls.
Wow.
And they're in excellent condition. I mean, even the hair is still is held up.
Okay.
And two are in like a goldish type of, I think they call them kabukis.
Okay.
I could be wrong.
Yeah,
I could
the
be
dress,
wrong.
Right.
But they're, yeah, I mean, but it's the authentic outfit of the time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I couldn't find those offhand, but obviously you don't want to sell them.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
All right. Well, thanks, Susan.
My
We're going to keep going on this.
Hero.
Well,
my daddy was my hero, and he was a soldier in Korea from 60 to 63. So they just mean a lot to me, and I'm just kind of.
Yeah, that's awesome you have that, though.
Yeah, it is. Thanks, Susan. We appreciate it. Thanks for calling in. Let's keep going. Let's go to Paul. Paul. What do you got, Paul?
Hey,
Paul.
Gentlemen, I've got a 33 and a third long play album that was basically distributed only to, I guess you back in those days, you might call them album-oriented rock stations, deep cut.
Okay.
The kind of stations that nowadays you see around the country that are basically the hosts are volunteer. It's very back then... those kind of stages were very uncommercial, but they were given an interview with David Bowie that was played on the air one time, maybe twice, and you mail in a postcard, and I'll be darned if I did not win that record. Now, these were not available to the public, radio stations only, and it was a 1977 interview with David Bowie.
So it's an LP of an interview?
Yes.
So,
on the inner liner has actual typewritten verbal outtakes to give these guys a heads up for when it was time for, you know, a break or a commercial.
Wait, so hold on. So is there somebody on the record interviewing him, or is it just him answering questions?
Yes. It's an interview.
Okay.
It's
so
an interview with David Bowie that was, you know, if you're old enough to remember, some people out there may have actually... remember hearing that interview. But
I might have it here. Is it a blue cover?
No.
The outside cover? Because there is a 1977 Rock Around the World interview for about $34.
Well, this is, he's got a kind of almost a fedora that's kind of half covering his face. It's really, and he's kind of leaning downward, and the hat, the brim of the hat is covering most of his face.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Paul.
You have to look that one up.
I would say probably around $35, $40, and I'd love it, too, that only David Bowie would be like, you know what would be great, Art? An interview of me.
Right.
It's like, send that around the world.
Right. I'm wondering if it's a picture disc as well, but we'll research that.
All right, let's go to Rob. Rob, what do you got? Quickly, what do you got, Rob?
I found a baseball in my mom's attic. It looks like about 30 players signed from the 69 Cubs team.
Okay.
Ball being league play ball in the box that the ball comes in. Definitely original signatures, not like mass produced. You know, some are a little softer and faded.
Right.
Everyone there, I would say probably except Leo DeRocher.
Okay.
So, what's the worth or any value?
I'm looking at anywhere from 50 to 500. And again, we've talked about this where the more autographs actually brings down the value than if you just had one or two main ones. But
if you just had Ernie Banks, you'd be like, that's Ernie Banks. But
right.
if you got
but
14,
if you have,
you know.
Like you said, everyone except DeRocher,
and
it's an auction.
I don't
think
it's the whole team because there's only like about 25 signatures. Okay. I think the team is much bigger than that, so I don't know. But,
I'm sure it's a few hundred bucks easily, though.
You know what's interesting, too, is Walter Jacobson came on the show and his little guilt during the Cubs World Series, he told us he was a bat boy, one of his jobs for whatever year that was,
wow.
1950s team, right? Was it 1950s team? He would be the one who once in a while would have to sign, like, the players.
Yeah,
like,
sign their stuff,
yeah.
Right. Nice.
Mary, you get the last one, Mary. Mary, what do you got?
Hi, Mary.
Hi, it's Century of Progress World's Fair, but it's a print that was made by Poster Plus on South Michigan in 1983.
Local.
It's 36 okay. by 24, and it's framed mint condition.
Wow. Trying to find it here.
We
real
do
quick
a lot
for
of
you.
World's Fair stuff on the.
Yeah, is it a red background kind of?
No, it's white with the. Well, I don't know what she was called. Standing
okay,
on the
globe. Okay, yeah, I see that. There's some for $11 and up.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a repro if yours is the original. That changes
it's
everything.
More.
So yeah,
there you go, Mary.
Thank
all
you
right,
for calling,
lucky
Mary.
Day, $11 and up. Hey, you know, some
you
questions. You know, Vic from Wooddale had some questions just about vinyl. Mm-hmm. You know, because that's becoming more of
a
thing
yeah.
for Secret Santa gifts and what have mm-hmm. you. But vinyl, I mean, is that going for anything when you get something that you find in a record store?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. To me, I collect more rock from 50s and 80s and 90s or 80s.
You just
said
the 70s.
Yeah. But some people specialize in jazz, and it is definitely hot. And they make great gifts. And even better is to find the funnier white elephant gifts
yeah.
for elephants, you know, or for records, you know, to find the old Barry, you know, Andy Gibb or something like that
right,
to give.
Right.
You know, and you can get those for whatever, 50 cents or something.
Going back to my Garfield, if you get the Garfield with Lou Rawls, where he does the Garfield record,
right.
where he does Garfield Noti, that's a good
right.
one. Greg Flam, great to have you back.
Thank you, Justin.
Meet, a rousing success here. Greg will be back next Thursday to answer your calls, give you advice, and let you brag to us, essentially.
Yep.
Thanks again. Great to
awesome.
See you, buddy.
Thank you, Justin.
Well, that's going to do it tonight here on The Download, 720 WGN. Patty Vasquez coming up next. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. Little sports news, 10 seconds to play. It looks like the Chicago Bulls have defeated the San Antonio Spurs.
Down go the Spurs.
The first road loss for the Spurs all year
long.
That's
right.
See, this team, there's something about it. They're like, I guess that's what we get. We get a Rajon Rondo and Dwayne Wade who are like, yeah, I'll play against the Spurs.
Well, I was laughing at you the last time we talked about this because you were talking about Rajon Rondo.
Right.
But here's the balanced scoring, though. You ready? One, two, three, four, five. Five players, all
yeah.
the starters in double digits.
There you
tonight.
Go. See, got probably a lot of assists for Rondo and company. But more importantly, I mean, it just feels like they'd like to get up for the big teams, and they just don't for the little teams. Man, it's like Dwayne Wade. It's like I don't mind losing to the Pistons.
Yeah.
Whatever. Who cares?
It's in Detroit.
Yeah,
it's a home game.